Yeah, to get out of here with, you can bring that up
Yes, you
underneath
do.
a little bit. 2092950. This is a song that intuitively captures the spirit of Cy War. It's a classic by Country Joe McDonald. You know the song. 2092950, an acoustic reward for your calling WBAI. We need 8, 9, 10, or 11 more of you right now in the next 2 minutes, 2, 3 minutes, or very close to that. 2092950. Support a radio station that believes its mission is to serve the public, not to serve the public to a company. To serve you, not to serve you up to an advertiser. We have no commercials. This is Pacifica Radio, damn it. And you are the brightest audience in the world at the brightest time of the day of the 5 o'clock shadow. And we are fighting that darkness that surrounds us at this time of day. You are the light. That phone is the photon. 2092950, area code 212. Just a minute left. Please help us out. Please help WBAI be here. We began by noting how close we are to a new war in Syria. Actually, you and I and the people of Syria are already in it. This nation, America, is backing the clandestine Contra wars. We saw it in Central America. We're seeing it today. Russia is backing off from Syria. Russia says, an insider with the Russian diplomatic delegation says that they will not stand in the way of a resolution that will do to Syria what was done to Libya. They are saying that they're going to cut off the equipment shipments to support the existing government of Syria. They want chaos. They want to go into Lebanon. They want to invade Iran. They want a permanent war economy made on your backs and mine. 2092950. Yes, we've got almost a bingo. 2092950. I got to get out of here. Michael G has to do some station business, right? 212-209-2950. This is a 5 o'clock shadow special. First day of the summer marathon. Help us out. Get us off on the good foot. On behalf of everybody, every brilliant soul at WBAI, and our even more brilliant listeners, please call 209-2950 with Thiago Barroso and Michael G. Haskins and everybody who believes in freedom, life, truth, and light. I'm Robert Knight for 5 O'Clock Shadow. Thank you so much.
Good morning. This is Earthwatch of the Wolf, or what have you. My name is Jim Freund. It's a conflation of Earthwatch and Hour of the Wolf. And for the next 3 hours, we are going to be remembering the work and life and fun and mulling over of the great Ray Bradbury, who died last month at age 91. Stay tuned. When I was 7 or 8 when I was 7 or 8 years old, I began to read the science fiction magazines that were brought by guests into my grandparents' boarding house in Waukegan, Illinois. Those were the years when Hugo Gernsback was publishing amazing stories with vivid, appallingly imaginative color paintings that fed my hungry imagination. Soon after, the creative beast in me grew when Buck Rogers appeared in 1928. I think I went a little trifle mad that autumn. It's the only way to describe the intensity with which I devoured the stories. You rarely have such fevers in later in life that fill your entire day with emotion. When I look back now, I realize what a trial I must have been to my friends and relatives. I was one frenzy after another, relation after one enthusiasm after one hysteria after another. I was always yelling and running somewhere because I was afraid life was going to be over that very afternoon. My next madness happened in 1931 when Harold Foster's first series of Sunday color panels based on Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan appeared, and I simultaneously discovered next door at my Uncle Bion's house the John Carter's of Mars books. I knew that the Martian Chronicles would never have happened if Burroughs hadn't been an impact on my life at that time. I memorized all of John Carter and Tarzan and sat on my grandparents' front lawn, repeating the stories to anyone who would sit and listen. I would go out to that lawn on summer nights and reach up to the red light of Mars and say, "Take me home." I yearned to fly away and to land there in the strange dusts that blew over Dead Sea bottoms towards the ancient cities. While I remained earthbound, I would time travel, listening to the grown-ups on warm nights, gathered outside on the lawns and porches to talk and reminisce. At the end of the 4th of July, after the uncles had had their cigars and philosophical discussions, and the aunts, nephews, and cousins had their ice cream cones and or lemonades, and we'd exhausted all the fireworks, it was the special time, the sad time, the time of beauty. It was the time of the fire balloons. Even at that age, I was beginning to perceive the ending of things, like this lovely paper light. I had already lost my grandfather, who went away for good when I was 5. I remember him so well, the two of us on the lawn in front of the porch, with 20 relatives for an audience, and the paper balloon held between us for a final moment, filled with warm exultations, ready to go. I'd helped my grandpa carry the box in which lay, like a gossamer spirit, the paper tissue ghost of a fire balloon, waiting to be breathed into, filled, and set adrift toward the midnight sky. My grandfather was the high priest, and I, his altar boy. I helped take the red and white and blue tissue out of the box and watched as grandpa lit a little cup of dry straw that hung beneath it. Once the fire got going, the balloon whispered itself fat, with the hot air rising inside. But I could not let it go. It was so beautiful with the light and shadows dancing inside. Only when Grandpa gave me a look and a gentle nod of his head did I at last let the balloon drift free up past the porch, illuminating the faces of my family. It floated over the apple trees, over the beginning-to-sleep town, and across the night among the stars. We stood watching it for at least 10 minutes until we could no longer see it. By then, tears were streaming down my face, and Grandpa, not looking at me, would at last clear his throat and shuffle his feet. The relatives would begin to go into the house or around the lawn to their houses, leaving me to brush the tears away with fingers sulfured by the firecrackers. Late that night, I dreamed the fire balloon came back and drifted by my window. 25 years later, I wrote The Fire Balloons, a story in which a number of priests fly off to Mars looking for creatures of goodwill. It is my tribute to those summers when my grandfather was alive. One of the priests was like my grandpa, whom I put to Mars to see the lovely balloons. But this time they were Martians, all fired and bright, adrift above a dead sea. And those are the words of Ray Bradbury.
Whoa.
That was a... That's going into the next piece, which we will get to, well, next. But let's have a preamble before that. On it was just a little over a month ago, it was about 5 weeks ago, that Bradbury died. And by a total coincidence, The New Yorker had done its very first ever, after lo these many years of publication and very highbrow, not posing, but attitudes about its publications, and much of which includes its fiction, there was a science fiction issue, and lo and behold, Bradbury had a piece in there, appropriately. He really can't talk much about science fiction and what it meant and what it means and all that without his voice. There was a long time when the three great Americans in science fiction were Bradbury, Heinlein, and Clark. Robert A. Heinlein, what am I saying? Clark, of course, is British. Asimov, and then Clark. So those are the stars in the galaxy, and there are a couple more with us still around, well into their 80s and 90s, but Bradbury was probably one of the brightest stars of all. And so Max Schmid, for Bradbury's 90th birthday a year ago, put together this wonderful WBAI premium that, in fact, we're going to be re-offering you for the next 3 hours, at least till 3 a.m., offering you over 22 hours of audio, all written by, about, or with Ray Bradbury. And perhaps we will have some extras that may be available through the internet or whatever. But I have to start now. I did play this 5 weeks ago, but or rather a month ago. But I'm going to have to play it again, the interview that I did with Bradbury. And I will tell you the story that I've told three times now in the last 6 weeks over the air, because I have to. And it comes down to my being a terrible, terrible student in school. I was never any good. And at one point, one of my teachers wouldn't even look at a book report I had written, because the book report was based on
The Martian Chronicles. It wasn't anything highbrow like Fahrenheit 451, but it wouldn't have mattered. It was science fiction and therefore not worthy. Now, this is in the late 60s, and don't kid yourself, that's an attitude that continued very much in many schools right through the 70s, as some college people can tell you. So, at any rate, I failed, and eventually I just left school. The day I was legally able to leave school, I did. I have not yet gone back. I've taught some school, but I've never gone to any school that I haven't paid for out of my pocket, and these are degreeless things, okay? So anyway, I finally got to meet Bradbury. He was here for to receive the National Book Award on the 40th anniversary of Fahrenheit 451. And our arts director helped arrange this thing, Matthew Finch. But one thing that we had to record right after the interview was a message from Ray Bradbury saying, "Dear blank blank, I will not tell you the teacher's name. Here I am in New York with Jim Freund, who you flunked out of school." This is like a Gene Shepherd story, right, Max? I know Max is listening. He'll be calling in a little while. "And you should never..." Well, he didn't quite say that, but he's saying, "I'm here to accept the National Book Award, and I understand that you failed this lad in school, and perhaps now, 40 years later, you'll rethink that decision." I mean, this is, like I say, a Gene Shepherd story. It's unbelievable, and yet it happened. I won't broadcast it because it gives away the identity, but this is just like, you know, when our lead youngster in A Christmas Story, or if you prefer, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, saves his family with a Red Ryder BB gun. No, because, and they wouldn't let him have it, and this is just the ultimate fantasy revenge. And that was mine, only it really happened. So, with that, I'm going to rebroadcast this because previously, when I played it, this is a month ago, it was the first time it had been on in quite a few years. And again, we have Max Schmid to thank for an amazing restoration job from reel-to-reel tape, only from the year 2000, but I have tapes from the 70s that are in better shape than that particular one was from 2000. It took him many hours and a great deal of work to restore the interview. But the last time it was on at about 1:30, and it's now 12:15, and a different audience, because normally it would have been on Hour of the Wolf, and here it is at an earlier, more prime time slot. So we will play this. I hope you enjoy it, but know that this is but one 24-minute segment of what you get with the, how many hours is it? The over 22 hours of material that we have on this premium. And to get this premium, the Ray Bradbury special, produced by Max Schmid, just call area code 212-209-2950 and pledge $60. And for that $60, you will get over 22 hours of Bradbury material. But and perhaps we'll have some specials or a link, a special secret link to people who donate with some newly recorded materials that I got at ReaderCon this last weekend. But here now again is that interview from 2000 from WBAI, an exclusive of ours, if you will. And I hope you enjoy it, and I hope that you enjoy it to the extent that you will call 212-209-2950 and pledge.
Hello, I am Jim Freund. With me is Matthew Finch and Ray Bradbury. Ray Bradbury is one of those people certainly need no introduction, but perhaps a reminder of what he has done is in order, because his work has covered so much of a scope that it's easy to forget some of those things that we take for granted. He has worked in just about every medium that exists. In radio, in television, he has authored 65 screenplays of his more than 500 short stories. He's written for the stage. He has been adapted or written 5 movies, including the screenplay of Moby Dick for John Huston. Am I missing any media?
A couple of operas, a musical with Jose Feliciano called The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit. And maybe it'll be here in New York sometime in the next year and a half. Off Broadway, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't believe in big theaters. I like small ones.
You began writing at about age 12 in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen a lot of history of literature and history of this country pass by in the scope of your writing. It was in the 40s, I believe, that you wrote The Fireman?
The late 40s, early 50s.
Of course, it would have to be
because
of the politics of that time.
Well, the politics really got rough around 1949, and John Huston and Lauren Bacall, people like that, Bogart, came back to Washington, D.C. There was a guy named Parnell Thomas who was head of the House Un-American Activities Committee. He was McCarthy long before McCarthy, And all the Hollywood people came out and turned tail and went home when one of the people who was supposed to testify didn't do a good job. It was stupid. I can't remember his name. And Jack Warner said, "Everyone home," and they all went home. And it sort of perked along there, and then McCarthy took over with Bobby Kennedy, of all people, you know. And everyone's forgotten that. It was very sad. And
were you already working with John Huston at that time?
No, I met John Huston when I was 31 in 1951. And on St. Valentine's night, I gave him all my books. And I said, "It's very simple. I love you. I love your films. Here's The Illustrated Man. Here's The Martian Chronicles. Here's Dark Carnival. And if you like these as much as I like your work, hire me someday." So he wrote me from Africa a couple of weeks later. He was doing The African Queen. And he says, "You're right, you know, someday we'll work together. I don't know on what, but I'll stay in touch." And in August of 53, he offered me the job of writing Moby Dick, and the rest is history.
Yeah, I didn't mean to derail you, but I had to know.
Yeah.
So you were talking about the late 40s and Parnell Thomas.
Yeah, who turned out to be a demi-criminal. I think they put him in jail a couple of years later.
Probably.
Something over income taxes, as I recall. Yeah.
Oh, got Al Capone and Spiro Agnew.
Anyway, long before that period, when I was a kid, I was a child of libraries. And when we'd go across country on Route 66 from Illinois to Tucson or Los Angeles, the first thing I did every night when we stopped to sleep overnight in the bungalow courts, that's what they were called, motels. They were a bungalow on stilts with chickens running wild underneath them, you know, a real primitive atmosphere. And I'd head for the nearest library. And when I get to the nearest library, whether it was Albuquerque or Amarillo or whatever, I'd check the shelves to see if there were any Oz books. There never were. Or any Tarzan books. There never were. And I could, and in some cases, a lot of other fantasy books that I wanted to see. And my perception of censorship grew at that time. It wasn't...
In the land of the free.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't a huge thing. You know, it was individual libraries. Yeah. There was no big movement. But a lot of intellectuals of both left and right have always been suspicious of fantasy. It didn't improve your mind. Yeah. Turned it into mush. And a good example of that is in the early 50s, there was a psychiatrist who became famous by destroying the comic magazines.
Yes.
And I can't remember his name.
Fielder?
No, well, he'll come back. I'll call you at 3 in the morning.
Yeah, I'm awake then. Let me just point out, by the way, that first of all, I started much of my reading because my parents gave me what they thought were two primers. R is for rocket and S is for space.
Yeah.
This started me on science fiction and has corrupted my life ever since.
I'm so
glad. That was the first thing that you did to me. The second thing that you did to me was turned me off school because I was failed in the sixth grade because I wrote a book report on the Martian Chronicles.
Ah.
And science fiction is not literature.
Oh, that's right.
Now it's required reading, but...
It's taken a lot of... I used to come back here, again, everything's in terms of 40, 43 years ago. And I used to come to New York, and I was publishing my first short stories and the Martian Chronicles, The Illustrated Man. And I'd go around to cocktail parties, and I'd meet people from the New York City Ballet in one room, and a bunch of lawyers and doctors in the other. And they all called me Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon. And there was no respect, huh? Okay. But every time I meet some of these people, I'd say, give me your name and address and phone number. And they'd say, why? I said, because the night we land on the moon, I'm going to call you. Because when the night we land on the moon is the greatest night in history, huh? And we all wept together that night. I called three people and said, stupid son of a bitch, and hung up. Yeah.
But this also goes to show what was going on in terms of schools not allowing certain kinds of books to even be reviewed. I don't know if my book review was ever read or looked about. I was very proud of it.
Sure. Well, no, there was no perception. And people didn't mean to be mean. They just didn't understand that science fiction is the fiction of ideas. If you want to stimulate kids... The ideas are, it's like pomegranates, huh? The metaphors are there. It's mythological. It's in terms of Greek and Roman mythology, Egyptian. And the remarkable thing is this, that during the last 40 years, the pyramid has been turned on its upside down. The kids have taught the teachers, huh? Instead of the teachers teaching from the top down, the kids taught from the bottom up and said to the teachers, on a daily basis, they'd come in and throw a copy of Heinlein on the table and say, hey, here's Robert Heinlein's book. And, oh, that junk? Well, read the first paragraph, teacher. And that she'd read the first paragraph and say, hey, that's not too bad. And slowly, Heinlein and Clark and Asimov and myself moved into the school system. But it took the kids to do it. Huh?
One of the things about science fiction and the fact that it was so easily disregarded is that people were able to get great political comment and political statement into science fiction writing and science fiction film. Mm-hmm. A movie with the statement of the day the Earth stood still could not have existed if that same statement were put into a mainstream movie.
That's true. Unless, in book form, if some important writer decided to become science fictional overnight, huh? Like Jessamyn West, who was a Quaker writer and a wonderful one, she wrote a little science fiction novel called The Pismire or something or other about Pismire ants in the future. And she never did another piece of science fiction. But there are a lot of other people who've come into the field, like Gore Vidal a year ago with a piece of science fiction.
Oh, and you did Visit to a Small Planet in the 50s.
That's right, sure.
Well, and you also have Margaret Atwood. Did,
that's right, yes.
There's Margaret Atwood and Doris Lessing and Vonnegut always walk that line.
They're not very good at it. They're rather windy, huh? And they don't know how to control themselves.
That's in tribute, by the way. That background noise is
that
in tribute
what that is?
To Fahrenheit 451.
All right, fair enough.
I wanted to ask a question. When you're dealing with a book that's now 40 years old and that's in the company of Brave New World in 1984, which I think Fahrenheit 451 is, how fair is it to judge a book like that by its prescience, by its being able to accurately envision what is to come, because there are so many details in here that are very chilling, and of those three writers, you're the only American, and there are numerous details in here that are very strong and very accurate, right down to the seashells that people wear in their ears. A seashell is a kind of radio transmitter you wear inside of your ear, almost exactly like a Walkman.
Yeah, when the Japanese invented that, they came to me. I was doing, they called, they wanted me to do a 1 minute interview with Kirk Douglas in my office, 1 minute. And it was for a Japanese coffee company, actually. But they came to the office and they brought with them the first Walkman radios. And there was about 50 of them I mean, when the Japanese make a film, they make a film. They were all producers, huh? And they all had Walkmans, and they came in and said, oh, please try this on, you know, this Fahrenheit 451. So, and I was just so delighted that they identified me with their invention. It's fascinating. One doesn't want to be judged by one's prescience, but there is a thing in the book that really nails it, where we're living in a time of MTV, huh? And our commercials on television, a one-minute commercial has 120 images. There's no space for thought, huh? In some cases, 200 images. They're afraid you're going to get bored, huh? Our magazines show it. I have a thing there where the Fire Chief Beatty speaks of the things being shortened and turned into obituary notices. Time magazine now has a page, or did have a few weeks ago, for several months, of reviews of books that were 30 words long, a review of a film 35 words long, a review of a stage play 47 words long. My God, that's a long one. And you look at that page, you say, Jesus Christ. And all the other magazines are imitating USA News, huh? Everything is fragmentized, and so that the centrifuge turns and thought is flung off. Huh? There are no central ideas or metaphors, and all of our magazines are like that, and they're full of ads. I talked to all the leading editors and publishers of the best magazines and newspapers in the world 2 years ago in Phoenix. And I said, for shame. And I had a stack of magazines with me up on the platform. And I said, here's good housekeeping. I dare you to find the articles. Come on, find the articles. 300 pages of ads. And I had a poem in there once a couple of years ago. Couldn't find the damn poem. Called the magazine. I said, where's my poem? And they came back on. They said, it's page 275, opposite the Lysol ad. I said, thanks.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and they're tremendously mixed messages, and especially in the women's magazines, between the health column and you turn the page, you can read an article about anorexia and how dangerous it is. Turn the page, and there's your classic anorectic sitting there selling you her life as if it's wonderful.
Oh yeah.
One of the things that really struck me is the Beatty. The chief fireman has a very long speech right dead center in the book. And one of the things he says about the death of books, or maybe death is too strong a word, but he says that this wasn't the state saying this stuff is bad. This was the state following the lead of the people gave up on it.
That's right. Yeah, it came from the bottom up, as with education today, that the good stuff comes up from the bottom too. Students teaching the teacher. But you don't have to burn the books if no one reads them. And if the teachers have given up teaching, you see, our problem today, we do not want to face it. Everyone's afraid of criticizing the teachers because it's a very powerful union, and they don't want to be criticized or tested, and they should. After all, I'm tested every day of my life. I've got a new novel out recently. It goes into the bookstores. If you don't like it, I'm out of business, huh? My head's on the chopping block. Why shouldn't the teacher's head be on the chopping block, too? Why shouldn't she be tested at the end of each year, especially in the first grade, to teach reading? Because they're shoving all the students upstairs, second, third, and fourth grade. And those teachers have to take over the job, and it doesn't get done, huh? So out of that, then, comes this terrible problem of the magazines trying to keep up with the morons, huh? Since no one's reading, you've got to put out a magazine for morons. And it's a catch-22. It keeps circling around itself.
Yeah, it's a little bit like our electoral system as well. I've always said that the largest voting bloc in the country is the fools. You know, it's caging the idiot vote is how you get elected.
It's otherwise known as the mental bloc.
Yeah,
organized.
Right.
Well, it's true in almost every country. When you look at people get so confused, and then they hand over the power to a dictator or a guy who's I think there's a quote on the back of the book here from ancient Greece or Rome, in which the people give over their. No, I guess it's somewhere else in the book. They give over their power to a nice guy, a scholar, who's going to protect them, a protector. And the protector turns into a tyrant.
as I was looking through the book, these numerous parallels came through. But one that didn't, or maybe it did in a strange way, is the role of the, quote, family in Fahrenheit 451. The family in this book is a three-wall video screen, in essence, of recurrent characters. It's kind of a television writ large. But you've spoken already quite a bit about children and how children learn. And what we're seeing now in the banning of books, and I'm not sure, maybe you can speak to how your experience with book banning played into this, is that often it is for the sake of the children that these things are banned. Certain books are not allowed because they may contaminate children with their ideas.
Yeah.
And it's either that or where if we talk about funding for the arts or for public broadcasting, they talk about the lack of money, that we don't have the money to spend on these things. Meanwhile, NASA, I think, has lost three satellites in the last 2 weeks worth billions of dollars.
But you're mixing things up here because NASA, that $1 billion, let's say, employed hundreds of thousands of people, and they were in turn educated in schools, and the money went in directly into people. It's not just space. I've had to argue this for years. I know Mr. Golden, the new head of NASA the last year. He's a brilliant man, and he's got a tough fight here. Because I was on TV the night we landed on the moon, and little Bernadette Devlin, that jerk, that Irish jerk, was on with me, and she was flapping her tongue. And I said, you know what your problem is? The back part of your tongue's not connected to your brain. And I said, you think all that money's been spent on the moon? We take shovels and put the money up there? It's been spent right here to improve the future, to give people hope for the future. So we have to separate that out from this other problem. If you take money away from our greatest hope is space travel. It's a substitute for war, for a change. We've never had a real substitute where we could go strain ourselves and force ourselves and be better than we ever hoped to be, because war denigrates and destroys. And we have all those tanks lying there, and they're going to lie there forever and not do anything for anyone. But once we get on the moon and we colonize it and we go to Mars, then our future is insured for the whole human race. And everyone on Earth will look up at the same moment and celebrate. So they're two separate things here. Yeah, two separate things.
Yet you have an ability. I think you're one of the first science fiction writers historically, to perceive technology in human terms. When everybody else was writing about the thrill of being out in space as a rocket jockey, you're writing about the widow and orphan on Earth.
That's right. Combinations of all sorts of things. And the Martian Chronicles is, you know, a blend of romance and fantasy and terror and practicality. The one story in there will come soft rains. 40 years ago, you couldn't build that house. Today, you could build it. If you did build it.
Oh, today it's...
You could do it for $100,000, and back then it would have cost millions. Yeah. So I'm like everyone else. I'm conservative liberal, or liberal conservative. Most people are. They put labels on themselves. It doesn't mean a thing. It comes down to humanity, and this whole problem, we're not dealing with censorship today. We're dealing with taste. Individual school boards may eliminate a book for a semester, but that's not censorship. That's taste for that year, and the book comes back the following year. And it's not permanent. If the government were doing this totally, it would be censorship.
Yet Fahrenheit 451, along with, I think it was Slaughterhouse-5, was burned in Indiana and in the last five years.
Yeah, one little case, you know. That's not, well, you can't turn that into a million cases, huh? And these people write me and say, would you come help? I say, no. And they say, why not? I said, if I show up, I'll dignify these sons of bitches. Huh? You deal with them directly. I would dramatize their lives. They'd take advantage of my fame if I showed up. But you deal with them. You're the librarian. When they leave the library, you put the book back on the shelf. Huh? And they come in a month later, how did that book get on the shelf? Gee, I don't know. Huh? And they take it off again. And you put it back again. And they take it off again, and you put it back. That's what the fight is. Huh? And as far as funding for the arts, there shouldn't be such a thing, because we've got 30,000 artists. How do you pick them? You're going to pick the Impressionists? They're still around, huh? You're going to leave them out? They're not avant-garde, huh? You're going to pick only the avant-garde? Well, then you leave out the Emperor. You see, it's too complicated. Huh? And anyway, you can go form your own art gallery and hang your pictures. It's a free society. There is no censorship of this sort of thing. And people like to think that there is. But I knew a group of artists in L.A. a few years ago, 30 of them, sculptors, workers in copper, inscriptions on copper, jewelry, sculpture, oil paintings, and they went and rented a space in Farmer's Market. They each put in $50 a month, and they hung their pictures and brought in their art things. And by God, at the end of 2 years, they were all in business, and they were selling their pictures, see? So you don't need help from the government. You should do it yourself, huh? And if people like you, they'll buy you, huh? I'm art-oriented. I have thousands of pictures I've collected. I've designed the covers on most of my own books. So I know what I'm talking about. And we shouldn't depend on government to do any of these things. I don't want money from the government to write a play. I was foolish enough 30 years ago to put in for a government fund in the Guggenheim. Well, it went nowhere, thank God, huh? I put on my own plays finally for $5,000, $100. You don't need money to put on a play. You need a storefront. You rent the storefront, or someone gives it to you for an evening. You tell 40 friends to bring their own chairs. And they bring the chairs into the storefront, and you put up little risers, you know, and you get up in the center stage. And Shakespeare said, when in doubt, stand in the middle of the stage, face the audience, and speak. That's what theater is.
What was the telephone number to subscribe to WBAI is 212.
But of course, the argument on the other side of it is that the government money is our money. It's our money, and why shouldn't we take a piece of it?
Well, because you cannot get from the people a vote on what kind of art they want to buy, huh?
It's self-determination if people give the money where they wish.
What if they're all Seurat lovers and Monet and Manet lovers, and there's still artists like that painting today, and the people who give money to the government say, well, give some to these people, huh? It's got to be fair, not just Andy Warhol or whoever, Jasper Johns, if you like him. But it's got to be completely fair, and that it hasn't been, huh? The ordinary artist of the past who paints well has been left out, yeah.
I'd like to sneak in one more question about sure. Fahrenheit 451.
Sure.
Do you believe that Truffaut captured the vision?
Part of it. The last reel especially. Every time I see it, I cry. Because it's beautiful. It's the book people walking in the snowfalls and repeating the names of the books, and the wonderful music by Bernard Herrmann.
Oh, great yeah. soundtrack.
But still, things were left out. And somewhere up ahead, I'd like to do the book, do the complete book, just shoot it right off the page.
Have you written a screenplay?
The book is the screenplay. And everything of mine is a screenplay. And I grew up, I've seen thousands of films, starting when I was 3, 1923, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Phantom of the Opera when I was 5. And when I met Sam Peckinpah 20 years ago, he wanted to do a film with me, Something Wicked. And I said, Sam, how are you going to do it? He says, I'm going to rip the pages out of the book and stuff them in the camera. I said, that's right. Yeah, because I didn't discover this about myself until I was older. And you pick up any page of any of my books, and it's in shots. Huh? Yeah, close up, long shots. Huh? Yeah.
It's been an honor.
Yes, thank
for
you.
For me, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ray Bradbury from the year 2000, when he won the National Book Award and was here at WBAI to be interviewed by myself and Matthew Finch, our arts director at the time. Hey, remember we had an arts department? Well, maybe that can happen again. Anyhow, 4 or 5 weeks ago it was that I was working with, I'll just bet I know who this is calling in. Is this you calling in?
Hello?
Hi there. Max?
Yes, this is me.
This is you. Okay. Yeah, you know what? Your phone sounds as bad as it does when I'm talking to you on my phone.
Well, gee, maybe I should turn the fan off that's blowing behind me.
Yeah, well, I've got two on in here. You should be so glad to not have shown up.
Well, the air conditioner went out?
That's right.
I thought it was failing this morning.
Well, it has failed by now. This is WBAI air conditioner fail. Big
time. I thought I was suffering at home.
Yeah, well, not as much as we're suffering here without you, Max.
Are we on the air, by the way?
We are.
Oh, but, well, let me start by saying you're selling the premium short. When you say it's 22 hours,
disc one is
22 hours.
Oh, my God.
Disc two is another 20 hours.
So it's over 42 hours, and yeah. I'm going to try to put together a little internet addition to it.
Well, I think I found a way to get more into it.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. I have this 2-minute, 58-second obit. Should I play that now, or should we...
Sure.
Yeah, we'll play that now. You stay on your phone there. Don't turn off your fan. Don't take off your shoes. Helps is on the way. And I'm just going to set this up by saying that I had spent the day working as a booth Betty at the Book Expo of America. And the word went out there that Bradbury had died. I was with Jame Gates. That's J-A-Y-M, Jame Gates. She is the PR representative of the Science Fiction Writers of America. And she had words from two different presidents about Ray Bradbury. And I will play you those words now. And she's going to set it up.
This morning, I was sitting at a table at Book Expo America, a big trade conference for the publishing industry, when we started seeing news that Ray Bradbury had passed. And at the time, we were having some trouble getting confirmation of it, the wireless not being the most useful there. And we started seeing authors, artists, people in the industry and out posting their remembrances, their shock and disbelief and their memories of him. And as the day went on, we started seeing more and more. And as of this evening, we have two beautiful remembrances from two presidents of vastly different groups and organizations who have been brought together by a common interest. Our first quote is from President Obama, posted on the White House official blog today. For many Americans, the news of Ray Bradbury's death immediately brought to mind images from his work imprinted in our minds, often from a young age. His gift for storytelling reshaped our culture and expanded our world. But Ray also understood that our imaginations could be used as a tool for better understanding, a vehicle for change, and an expression of our most cherished values. There is no doubt that Ray will continue to inspire many more generations with his writing, and with our thoughts, and our thoughts and prayers are with his family and friends. That was posted by the President of the United States this morning. I'm talking about his personal reaction to this wonderful author who has been a pillar of our community. I also had a chance to talk to John Scalzi today, president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, and which is a group that is dedicated to advocacy and support of the science fiction and fantasy writers around the world. Scalzi said, simply put, it is the end of an era. Ray was more than just an author, more than just a grand master. He was one of the pillars of our community. It is no coincidence that one of our major awards is named after him, the Ray Bradbury Award for Outstanding Dramatic Presentation. It is impossible to count the number of authors who have been influenced by his work. He was a writer of fantastic ideas, but he was more than just the ideas. He was about the words. He was one of the writers of our genre who could show the power of the words themselves. He used words in a way that continues to inspire joy in his readers and envy and admiration in his peers. We mourn his passing, but much more than that, we celebrate the arc of his life, his contribution to our literature and community, and the worlds that he left us.
Okay, so again, that was James Gates of the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America. And with me now on the phone, the creator of this morning's premium, or last Sunday's premium, or actually the 90th birthday premium, was this not?
Well, it was, but I have been spending the last week upgrading the sound quality on many of the programs that were on it before. So this is a new thing, and we're going to be adding some interviews that have turned up subsequently. If I can squeeze any more on here. I mean, this was jam-packed the first time, and some of these sound upgrades are bigger files than before, so I'm rearranging and resampling a few things.
Yeah,
to make everything we have fit.
I did find an hour 25, that was Mike Hodel's show, which was an interview with both Norman Corwin and Bradbury from 1989.
That's which, one of the things.
That can't be Mike Hodel, because by 1989, Hodel was dead, I believe. But it's an hour 25, nevertheless.
Well, let me explain what we have here. I have scoured every resource known to man and downloaded and otherwise retrieved from reel-to-reel tapes many copies of most of these programs. Now, Ray Bradbury started to be adapted for the radio in 1946. I think he was only about 25 at the time.
Yeah.
And the first existing program from his work was something called the Mole Mystery Theater, a horror story, or a crime story, actually, called Killer Come Back to Me, starring Richard Widmark.
Ooh.
And the first several adaptations of his work on radio were from his horror. His first book was Dark Carnival, wasn't it? First collection?
I think it probably was.
And that was,
I mean, he certainly started with horror. He was largely inspired by, of all things, people wouldn't guess it, Lovecraft and the Lovecraft Circle.
So that's where we find most of his early radio work, but by 1950, when he was, I think the Martian Chronicles must have been written by then, yes? Because there were many adaptations from stories of the Martian Chronicles that were done on Dimension X first.
Well, the Martian Chronicles, being a series of short stories, I think it was written during the 50s, and they were basically, you know, being ripped from the pages of Galaxy Magazine, among other places, and put onto Dimension X and X-1, which I believe were both of those affiliated with Galaxy?
One was Galaxy, and the other was, what was the other?
Astounding,
yes. Yeah. They switched affiliation, because there was a 6-year gap between the two shows.
Yeah.
Dimension X was in 1950, and X-1 was 6 years later.
Yeah, by X-1, I think most of the Martian Chronicles would have been written. But, you know, in some ways, he never really gave it up, did he?
And, you know, this project, at least the heart of it, was a project that Paul Wunder, my mentor at WBAI, the man who put me on the golden age of radio and said, I'm going to stop doing this show. So if you want it to continue, you do it.
And he started that show. 1978. Yeah, he started the golden age of radio.
Well, he originally took all of the Martian Chronicles stories and strung them together into one massive program. And since that time, I have been updating it every time a new improved sound quality copy came up. And new stories were found from other series that were lesser known. And it's now a 2.5-hour radio drama, The Martian Chronicles. That's part of the first disc. The first disc is all the old-time radio material, and the second disc is all the things that have been done subsequently in more modern times, shall we say.
Yeah, by the way, you are absolutely right. The Martian Chronicles came out as a collection in 1950.
So like Gene Shepard, he took all of his short stories and strung them together and called it a book or a novel.
It's not a novel. It's a collection of short stories. I mean, he never pretended it to be otherwise. And in fact, those who really try to track it well will see that there are moments of discontinuity between, you know, one story and another when you get down to it. He was just writing short stories, and then he didn't do a fix-up, which is what you would call what Shepard did.
Yes, that's true. He wrote little short pieces to string the stories together.
Yeah.
Bradbury did have his device of, and then the third rocket came.
Yeah.
You know, the first rocket met with disaster, the second rocket met with disaster.
Almost like real life. So many of our missions to Mars have had issues.
Well, on the second disc, there are a number of stereo programs. There's a Canadian version of Dandelion Wine that is 2 hours, 4 half-hour episodes.
Yeah, that's really good, by the way. I like that.
It's an adaptation of Golden Apples of the Sun. I don't even know where that came from.
Hmm.
There are readings from a variety of reading series, some with big-name stars, and others just readings by hosts of shows like Hour of the Wolf.
Yes.
A series called Mind Webs is responsible for several, like Kaleidoscope and Foghorn.
We did a radio adaptation. Steve Erickson did one of Kaleidoscope. And I do not recall what became of it.
I have not heard that one.
I'm in it.
There's a South African series called SF-68. I wonder when they produced that.
Can't imagine.
And they did an adaptation of Sound of Thunder. And just, you know, everything I could find of Ray Bradbury, including your interview, I've even tossed in a Gene Shepard show where he talks about Fahrenheit 451.
Right. Then there's an interview. Here's a Hodel, 1976, with Jerry. How do you pronounce his last name?
Heindiges.
Heindiges. Okay, yeah. It looked like something.
Jerry did another documentary. He has a show out on the West Coast and over the internet, and he interviewed some people who were putting together the big stereo cinematic sounding series and how they started. So he interviewed the people, I forget their names, who created a series that appeared on NPR in, I think, the 80s or 90s.
Yeah, was that the Beyond 2000 with that Yuri?
I think it was called Bradbury 13.
Oh, that series, right, yeah. Okay. Yeah, one of NPR's.
One is all the old-time radio. You get the likes of, there are 9 assorted series, like Escape and NBC Short Story and Radio City Playhouse. Then there are 8 episodes of Dimension X, 10 episodes of Suspense, 7 episodes of X-1, and among these episodes are various versions by different adapters, because Ray, of course, did not write for the radio himself, but his stories were adapted by some of radio's greatest, Morton Fine and David Friedkin. Ernest Canoy and his partner at Dimension X and X-1, whose name is escaping me at this moment. When there are different versions, they are entirely different scripts and casts, and we've left them all in so that people can get a sense of how the work was adapted for the radio. So there's over 22 hours of old-time radio on disc one, and then the second disc is the Dandelion Wine, Golden Apples, stereo productions, other productions, readings. Oh, Something Wicked This Way Comes, which was produced from the soundtrack of the motion picture.
I remember that.
But for the radio, they went out and got a narrator, Orson Welles.
Right. And then they used sound from the movie.
Yes, it's mostly the movie soundtrack, but Orson Welles narrates it. So that's a 90-minute radio production. There's over 20 hours on the second disc, so you got over 40 hours, 42 or more hours, plus the interviews that we're going to be adding. All of this for a $60 pledge, by the way, to WBAI.
Yeah, so it's $1.20 an hour or something like that. Not a heck of a lot, given everything that we are offering.
And, you know, you might be able to go find all this stuff yourself, but I've already done it for you. And this, you know, I've weeded through, I've gotten the best copies available of all of these programs from every conceivable source.
Now, you wouldn't be able to find the interviews, you know, unless you tape them off our air and off KPFK and our sister stations.
And, you know, let's stress that this is, you know, some brilliant storytelling in the best medium for storytelling, radio drama.
The second best medium. I like the printed word.
But that's why we have the readings included as well.
Exactly. And but even before there was the printed word, there was the spoken word, and Bradbury was very good on it. I'm surprised that he never actually wrote for the radio. He wrote so many screenplays. I mean, Something Wicked, This Way Comes, was written as a screenplay before it was written as a book.
And didn't he write something called The Ice Cream Suit for the stage?
There are six plays that he wrote for the stage. The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit is the name of the collection. It's the name of one of the plays. They're all one-act plays, and I would advise people who really love Bradbury to not go see them. You know,
and
but
of course, the works adapted for EC comic books that put them on the map, too.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there's so much. It really isn't a medium that he didn't touch. The Martian Chronicles, of course, was done as a TV series starring who you might call, Max, the old man. Darren McGavin.
And who was he, Spender?
Oh, I don't remember. Rock Hudson was in it as well.
But, you know, there's something about the TV adaptations. It's visual flash, but was it that good? You know, some of these radio shows, when I hear them, and I've heard one of the stories from the Martian Chronicles, where the guy goes rogue and becomes a Martian, and shoots up the town to save it from the Earthmen. And, you know, it's just such a brilliant story and told so well on the radio that, you know, there's no way TV could do it justice. This is theater of the mind. I hope people are calling to pledge for it. $60.
Yeah, so far, nobody yet. Nobody yet. We have to give the phone number.
That's an idea.
212-209-2950. And what you will be doing is you will be, well, several things at once. You will be thanking us for all the work that Max has done to put this together. I don't know how many hours you spent just to revive that interview I did. First, you had to bake it, literally.
Yes, we baked it.
We literally baked it. I have the photo on Facebook of what happened to the reel. It goes into an oven for a period of time to make the oxide manageable.
Yes, it has to dry out.
And then,
They cooked up a bad batch of tape that was in use for 20 years.
Yeah.
And so every tape that was low-noise tape from the 80s and 90s is basically requires this process to get the sound off of it.
Yeah.
And even then, there were some issues where there were splices that kind of melted. So, you know, I noticed an artifact or two when you played the interview, but and I played it backwards and forwards to get some of the glitching in different spots.
Yes, exactly. But overall, it ended up sounding pretty good, I must say. And I'm so pleased because that's a very, very important interview to me. And I hope that people have enjoyed it as well. And I hope that you will call up and pledge, A, for the fact that we had that interview and we're the kind of radio station that cares enough to do material with Ray Bradbury and other luminaries and upcoming people in science fiction, B, who appreciate still the golden age of radio here on WBAI New York. Hey, I got a break in there. And C, to tell the powers that be, some of which are new, the programming, our new program director, Chris Hatzis, that this is a kind of programming that you want. Golden Age of Radio, science fiction, literary radio. Robert Knight covers some of this as well. And, you know, that you want more of this. And that you're willing to support the station to get it. And And for all that, for a $60 pledge, we will give you over, well over 40 hours, possibly by the time we're done, almost 45 hours of Ray Bradbury material if you call now, 212-209-2950. Be the first person to start off, now that it's 1 a.m., to start off this hour in pledging, 212-209-2950.
And remember, you can't get this anywhere. This is the result of weeks of backbreaking labor on my part.
Yeah, one call coming in, by the way. Thank you.
And, you know, I mean, this is only available as a gift, a thank you gift, when you support WBAI, and that's what it's about. The station is going through some very difficult times. The whole network is going through some very difficult times. And we really need to hear from people in the audience who appreciate the literary efforts of Jim Freund. Now, what is it, 1:30 to 3?
Now, currently 1:30 to 3. But Hour of the Wolf itself in its 41st year.
And the Golden Age of Radio, well, I've lost track. I took it over in December of 1978, but I was producing for it for about a year before that, when it was under the auspices of Paul Wonder,
I think
offshoot Paul's... of Soundtrack.
Well, what year did Jaws come out? I can help.
No, it was Close Encounters.
It was Close Encounters that you came in.
Ah, okay, Jaws was.
But Jaws is how I date Paul Wonder coming in.
Ah, I think that might have been 76, or was it earlier?
It's like 75, 76. But that's about the time that Paul came into the station. And he and Jack Shug were doing... I think Paul started alone, then Jack Shug joined in.
No. Please, I brought Shug in.
Ah, it's your... okay.
Hey, everyone seems to think Shug started it, but no. I brought him in.
Oh, and I never thought Chuck started.
I found out how grueling it was to produce radio, and I needed an assistant. I mean, some assistance.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Yeah, Jack did take... due credit.
I first noticed, you know, there was a magazine called FM Guide, and that's how I discovered... Well, I had known of BAI earlier because of Doctor Strange adaptations.
Yes,
that were on a show called The Radio in 1970.
By the way, somebody, I don't know who, I'm suspecting that, I can't tell because it only gives me a phone number. It might be James, says it was six weeks ago this Tuesday last that Bradbury left ... And I assume that either that's what they wrote, or they mean that he left, shuffled off the mortal coil. But
well,
yes, it was on Tuesday, but the announcement was on Wednesday.
Yeah.
The announcement was on Wednesday. We have a $60 pledge. Thank you very much. So
hopefully the first of many.
Somebody started the snowball rolling.
This is you know, I think that this is one of the finer things I have ever put together. You know, not just a compilation of shows. I mean, it is a compilation of shows, but with a specific theme. And, you know, it would take anyone, as it took me, weeks, months of work to put this kind of thing together. Well, we've done it for you. And it really is a great way to remember the work of Ray Bradbury, or introduce maybe a kid to the work of Ray Bradbury.
Yeah, I mean, I am talking with others. Angelique, by the way, we've one person answering the phones.
Antoinette.
Say again.
Well,
Antoinette. Oh, my God.
The
one thing you do not do is get people's names wrong. That is rude, and I just did it. I apologize. How are you? How are things? Yeah, I told you it was hotter in here than in there, didn't I? So we got one pledge so far from, I am not wearing my glasses. can you read that for me?
What a strange name.
I'm going to open a mic over there for you. So you can just tell us who called in. I am the least... that mic right there. Just lean it toward you, Antoinette.
All right, we got a pledge from George Darrow.
Ah,
Shorewood.
George.
Yes, George is an old friend of WBAI.
Yes, he mentioned that when he was what he called. So
yeah, he used to actually, his father and then he owned an antique toy store around the corner from the radio station when we were on 62nd Street.
Great.
And it was so cool.
Awesome. Yes, he's very excited, and he's very excited about the Ray Bradbury series.
I don't know if the store is there anymore, but there's a website where you can look at cool stuff.
I think Fun Antiques. Yes.
That was Fun Antiques.
That was the name of the store, and I think that's the name of the website.
Great.
Great.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Great. Hopefully more calls come in. I'm actually the only person in that room besides one other guy who's sleeping right now. Uh-huh. So let me go back in there and take more calls.
Thank you so much. I don't have the mic on for the ringing, so you have your privacy in there. But I can, in theory, unless I screw it up, which I always do, in theory. Also, could you do me a favor? Could you give me the names of yourself and whoever else is in there so I can thank everybody properly on the air and not screw up as I have already done on the air? Yeah, or you can just... Yeah, I know. But gee, you know, if you need a pen? Here. If you folk want to be cruel, call in two calls right now, 212-209-2950. Oh, you look so dubious.
No. Into the microphone, Jim.
Oh, okay, yes, thank you, Max. You're always saying into the microphone, Jim. I remember when you had to take me off the microphone.
Turn away from the microphone, which makes it hard to hear you.
One famous Halloween. What year was that?
Get out from under the console, Jim.
No, the problem was I was over the console. You shouldn't have put me on the air to begin with. Thank you. So it's just you. Just you. Thank you. So call up. When you call up, say hello to Antoinette, who is answering the phones for us and womaning the volunteer room all by her lonesome butt. That is to say, she will take your call at 212-209-2950, and she will take your pledge. And again, Max?
Yes?
You pitch!
Putting this together was really a labor of love on my part. I was introduced to Bradbury, as I'm sure many were, by reading The Martian Chronicles. And that was maybe the first adult science fiction I read. I had gone through some of the teenage books. Remember something called Tunnel in the Sky?
Of course, Murray Leinster. Yes, absolutely.
I thought it was, and that was the
wait,
first.
Unless I'm going to, I'll look it up in my browser.
The woman writer with the man's name. Not that one, the other one.
Andre Norton?
I think that's who it was. And here's a story about twins, one who goes into space. And they age at different rates. And, you know, I mean, it's just the human emotion was something I was not used to from the world of comic books, which is where I had come
from. I'm sorry, it was Heinlein.
Oh, it was? Okay,
yeah.
Well. But this was one of those teen books, and, you know, that was my introduction to science fiction on, you know.
Yeah, and in those days we called them juveniles. Now it's called... young adult fiction. But in them days, those were the Heinlein juveniles. He wrote Any Number, which also provided the basis for Trouble with Tribbles and lots of...
But
the Rolling Stones.
You know, something more to them, and that was my introduction to the literary world.
Yeah.
When I was supposed to be reading Silas Marner or something else equally exciting.
Yeah. Bradbury and Clark and Heinlein and Asimov were among the original things that launched most people. My first Bradbury was S is for Space and R is for Rocket, which were given to me because my parental units thought that these were, given the titles, for young people. And while Bradbury wrote for young people, those were not it.
Maybe I should run down some of the titles that are included.
If people call right now, 212-209-2950.
From Dimension X, we have To the Future, dystopian future, as I recall. Then perhaps one of their most stirring adaptations was indeed the first... I guess To the Future was science fiction as well, but they did a two-part There Will Come Soft Rains and Zero Hour.
How many versions of There Will Come Soft Rains do you have?
Yeah, I think there are three different ones. There's a short version and an expanded version. And they did it again when they did the Martian Chronicles complete. Why do I not see that on the list? I guess because it's included complete in the Martian Chronicles compilation. But that's odd. You would think the Martian Chronicles episode would be here, but I seem to have omitted it. I may have to correct that.
Well, dear.
Mars is Heaven. They did an adaptation. They did a different adaptation on Escape, which is also included. And The Moon Be Still as Bright.
Now, that's the one.
That is just a brilliant story. Ah, there's Mars is Heaven. They did it again. First, as the 14th episode of the show, and they redid it as the 33rd episode of the show. And then The Veldt.
By the way, one person is calling in right now. Thank you. Let's get a couple more calls.
212-209-2950. That's the number to call. Marionettes Incorporated. Kaleidoscope.
Oh, that's a nasty little one, Marionettes Incorporated. Wasn't that also done for TV at some point?
I believe so. It was Burgess. I recall Burgess Meredith doing a version of that somewhere.
That sounds right, yeah.
Now, on Suspense, it's interesting how Bradbury came to Suspense. Bill Spear, who also produced and directed the Sam Spade radio show, was married to a woman named Kay Starr, who was apparently a big mover and shaker in show business. And she was reading Bradbury stories and got her to meet her husband, Bill Spear. And at that meeting, they bought Summer Night. And Rio Bushinska, thus died Rio Bushinska. And those are the first two stories that were adapted on Suspense. They were horror stories, followed by The Screaming Woman with Little Margaret O'Brien.
Oh, yes. That's Little Margaret O'Brien. How old was she then? She's probably on the radio, she was probably older than she was in the movies at that point.
1948. We'll have that.
Oh, that's still pretty young.
Then Dana Andrews in a story called The Crowd, a detective searching for a psycho killer.
Ah.
Then they... 5 years later, they did The Screaming Woman again with a new ingenue. Then they adapted Zero Hour, which I played on Sunday night on the Golden Age of Radio. One of my favorite stories of all. Jeanette Nolan and William Conrad starring in something called The Whole Town Sleeping.
Ooh, by the way, our tally is now up to 120. Thank you.
Let's go. 212-209-2950. Now, there have been some incredibly bad copies of The Whole Town Sleeping, which may have originally been called The Ravine. That may be the title of the story. But Suspense did it three times. Jeanette Nolan did it first, and it's really the best one. William Conrad narrates. There's a brilliant musical score. It is just fantastic radio. They did it again with Agnes Moorehead in 1958.
So that's the one I remember, the Agnes Moorehead one.
I have discovered the version that we had before was a horrible mess, and I have now discovered a new copy of that is complete and not all chopped up the way the one on the previous version of this premium had been.
Ooh.
And they did Kaleidoscope, which was done on several different radio shows.
I think everybody has done Kaleidoscope at some point or another.
Now let's turn to X-1 from 1950.
I even have a song version of Kaleidoscope.
Ah, Dwellers in Silence. Now that's a beautiful story.
That's semi-Lovecraftian, wouldn't you say?
Dwellers in Silence?
Yeah.
Well, that's the last story adapted from the Martian Chronicles, where a crew from Earth goes back to Mars and finds a family all alone.
Oh, it's that one.
Yes.
Okay.
Beautiful stuff. And Zero Hour again with Nina Ritter this time in the lead.
That's a familiar name. I'm not sure why, but it's a familiar name.
And as I said, amongst the assorted radio shows, there's something called Biography and Sound. It's a full hour called Ticket to the Moon, and it features interviews with many science fiction writers, including Ray Bradbury. That was put together in 1956.
Yeah, and I have a copy of that with me, in fact.
Now, CBS
Not counting the CD. I, of course, got the CD that you left for me.
On the CBS Radio Workshop, they actually had Bradbury introduce two of his programs, or two of his stories, Season of Disbelief and Hail and Farewell, starring Dick Beals, who was an actor who never developed his secondary sexual attributes.
Oh, that's right.
He never grew a beard, he never grew tall, and his voice never developed, which made him a perfect fellow to play young boys on the radio, which he made a career of.
Yeah, and
this story is almost his life story. Story of a man who's trapped in a child's body, who goes from family to family of childless families and, you know, brings them a child.
And I seem to recall that he knew Bradbury and vice versa.
Well, maybe this story is based on his life story, but it's a more great radio that, you know, you need to hear. And you can set aside the rest of the summer into the fall to hear all of these things, because 44, 42, some number of hours of Ray Bradbury material
and
is
many
what
of
we're
the...
offering you on two MP3 discs for a $60 pledge to keep WBAI alive.
Yeah, and if you were to listen to one a day, most of these are half an hour long, you would be well into the school year.
Oh, here's one that wasn't done anywhere else, The Rocket.
Yes.
This is the one about the old Giuseppe, or whatever his name was, who decides to build a rocket in his backyard and give the kids a trip to the moon.
Yeah, and that was sort of done, or at least the premise was taken for a TV movie starring Andy Griffith.
The Wind from Radio City Playhouse, another horror story.
Yeah, I don't know that.
And who hears the wind talking to me. And something called The Lake, which is, it transcends genres. It's kind of a ghost story.
Yeah, Bradbury was never really concerned. His science fiction, the science wasn't very good, which annoyed a lot of people. He was one of the first people to say, I don't care, I'm telling a story here.
And a lot of his story centered on nostalgia in one way or another.
Memories
of childhood and old United States. You know, even Mars is Heaven, where they find a place on Mars that's like, you know, 1920s anywhere USA.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, that piece that I read about Bradbury's writing the Fire Balloon that was in the New Yorker. He is so... When I think of Bradbury, I always have the vision of some lonely house in the middle of a prairie with a rocket ship going off in the background, traveling somewhere, probably Mars. And it's a great vision that Bradbury created. And... by the way, one more call is coming in. Thank you very much.
212-209-2950.
There's actually one conscious person in the room, Antoinette, and one, well, less than conscious person in there. But you can call anyway, and if needs be, we'll put you on hold. Heck, if it gets to it, I'll take calls off air here, and Max can talk. I don't have any pledge blanks in here. I ought to go get a couple at the next possible break so that if I do have to take calls, I can. But, yeah, 212-209-2950.
Another thing, though, Dandelion Wine isn't horror, it isn't science fiction. This one falls more in the realm of actual nostalgia.
Yeah, and it's sort of fantasy.
Yeah, it's fantasy. Well, yes, I guess that's really... what it is.
Today people would call it a slipstream, where, you know, it is and it isn't science fiction. It's interstitial, another word that is being used very much within the literatures of SF. And Bradbury sort of, in those days, most magazine empires had two books. You had Amazing Stories and Fantastic Stories. You had Astounding and Worlds of Wonder. You had Galaxy Magazine and Worlds of If. You had a few of them were like the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, FNSF. Although, for a brief period of time, they had another magazine that I think was called Vanguard. So, everything was either science fiction or fantasy, and Bradbury was one of the few people that walked the line between.
And, you know, his rise was not, you know, meteoric. I mean, he made a splash when he first hit, but he was writing in the library. He was writing for, what, 5 cents a word or something?
He was writing
terribly
for,
successful when he was starting out.
He was writing for fanzines, you know, on the very first, pardon me, what they called APAs, Amateur Press Associations, where everybody owned a mimeograph. And you would send the story in. Lovecraft had the Lovecraft Circle, and he was submitting stories to various things in the Lovecraft Circle. That was a zero pennies a word. So he got, and he was about 13 or 14 when he started doing that. So, yeah, he was an overnight sensation after about 20 years.
Here there be tigers. There was an old woman. A sound of thunder, the felt, the happiness machine. I'm just reading some more of the titles of Stereo Productions. Night Call Collect.
I should take a look and see how many movies there were. Not that they're on these CDs, rather. But just to remind people how important Bradbury was to American and international culture. So,
you know, one I never saw was The Illustrated Man.
You've never seen that?
No, I don't believe I ever have.
You really should. You might be one of the few people like me who likes that movie. Rod Steiger and Claire Loom doing each of the short stories with a bit of, there's that word again, interstitial story to tie them together. And on that they did The Veldt. Which is the story in which the parents, in which the sun is going to burn up the earth. And so the parents put their kids to, you know, they kill their kids in their sleep. So they won't.
Hey, I don't know that one.
Ooh, yeah. And then they,
hey, here's an interesting title, Pedestrian. Illegal to Walk. A true California story.
I love The Pedestrian. It is a weird tale. In the best sense of the word.
Well, here's one, you know. It's on disc two. It's at the bottom of disc two.
Maybe we'll play it later on. We're here for 3 hours, and I'm certainly going to...
Yeah, maybe it's time we listen to a little Bradbury.
I
could either direct you to some short ones, or, you know, we could just pick something. There's just so much to choose from that it's hard to know what to pick.
Yeah, I'm just right now, I'm just looking him up on IMDb just to see how many movies he was involved with. Guess what? Ray Bradbury's Kaleidoscope will be coming out as a movie later this year. Oh, short subject. Interesting. And they list here The Pedestrian. I can't imagine that The Pedestrian wasn't done as like a Twilight Zone or something like that. Of course he wrote It Came from Outer Space. Let us not forget that. The Halloween Tree. He won an Emmy Award for that. He's credited for a movie version of Little Nemo. He's credited for an episode of Alfred Hitchcock.
Which one? Is that The Jar?
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
Yes, it is.
I haven't seen that since I saw it originally. It scared the living crap out of me.
Yeah. He did two Twilight Zones when George Martin was in charge of the Twilight Zone, although each one is three, because they were one-hour episodes, and each episode had about three stories, and I cannot tell from the titles which one are the Bradburys. Like one is The Elevator to See the Invisible Man, which I know is a Robert Silverberg story.
Right.
And Tooth and Consequences.
Not sure. I would
so probably The Elevator.
I don't know.
Probably The Elevator. Ah, and another call is coming in. Thank you very much. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. He, of course, wrote the screenplay for Something Wicked This Way Comes, Spaceship Earth. I'm going back in time, obviously. Of course, The Electric Grandmother from his story, I Sing the Body Electric, and he wrote that screenplay. Also,
Twilight Zone, or did they make a movie of that, too?
Whoop, I just missed where I placed that.
They did do it on the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, this is 1982.
Oh. Okay.
So, I don't know. It may have been it just says TV movie.
And then there was that Ray Bradbury Theater, which I don't think I ever watched, but I know it was there.
Yeah, it was. I think it was a Canadian show or something like that, wasn't it?
It was on Showtime, or it was on one of the cable channels, which may be why I didn't see it. I may not have had that service at the time.
Yeah, and of course Fahrenheit 451, done by Francois Truffaut. And there was rumored to be another version of it in production a couple of years ago, but it's not happening at this time.
Now, didn't he write the screenplay for Moby Dick? Of course he did.
Of course he did. He won the Academy Award for it.
And he wrote his own space Moby Dick called Leviathan 99.
Did he do that?
Yes, he did.
Oh, good God.
And basically, it was the same story. It was Ahab in space.
Yeah, the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, of course, is based on his short story, The Foghorn.
Which is included on one of these modern radio adaptations.
CBS Television Workshop did Rocket in 1952.
Who did?
CBS TV Workshop.
Oh, I know about the radio workshop. I didn't know they had a TV workshop.
I guess they did. And another call coming in. Thank you very much. I mean, yes, we should play some of this stuff, but right now, calls are coming in one by one, and with only Antoinette there to take care of the calls coming in. Slow and steady wins the race, as it were. 212-209-2950 is the...
I would recommend, I don't know, just off the top of my head, because it's short.
Yes.
There Will Come Soft Rains.
Ah.
The first half of Dimension X number 11.
Which disc is that on?
The old-time radio disc is disc one.
Disc one.
Let's see which is the most pristine version of it. Maybe you should use the X-1 number 78, which is the last X-1 in the folder of X-1.
Now, can you tell me why, if I put this into the CD player, you think I should use the computer, huh?
Yeah, I don't know if it will read my folders.
Ah, yes.
The CD player plays only one file format, and it might actually come out sounding like chipmunks, as we've discovered.
Yeah, do not, by the way...
odd format... MP3s and try to play them with the CD player.
Yeah, do not. You should not need to worry about that with your CD player necessarily at home. We're talking about
our professional slick CD players that will only play one format.
Exactly. So I just wanted to tell people
our $12,000 CD players that won't play some formats.
Okay, so
$1,200. Let's not exaggerate. We don't have that kind of money to throw around at WBAI.
Yeah, indeed. Ah, here we are, the OTR. Okay, so which directory am I looking for now?
X-1.
Okay, I'm there.
Last one. There Will Come Soft Rains and Zero Hour.
Okay.
But, you know, I think There Will Come Soft Rains is enough for now.
Yeah, and how long is that? That is,
the whole thing is
28 minutes.
This is the first half. Maybe should we set up the story? I guess they must do it themselves, but not in the context.
Not in the context, and not with the phone number.
Basically, the reason they go to Mars in the Martian Chronicles is because they blew up the Earth. And this is the story of how they blew up the Earth, or what happened just after they blew up the Earth.
Yeah, you know, and I'd like to wait for at least a few more seconds, because in theory, at 1:30, Hour of the Wolf begins. If it weren't a fundraising drive. And therefore, probably on the Internet Archive, people will be hearing things as of now. It's 1:30 a.m. in New York City.
And, you know, the first half of the show has been a stealth broadcast, because outside of Jim and various people at the station, a lot of people didn't know it was even happening, although you did post something on your Facebook announce.
I put it on Facebook, on Twitter, and Google+.
But let's welcome people just tuning in. I'm speaking with Jim Freund on Hour of the Wolf, and I'm Max Schmid. You are a friendly host and producer of the Golden Age of Radio, heard 7 o'clock Sunday nights. An extended four-hour program this week, by the way, when we will be featuring ultra-rare, incredibly lost, and now rediscovered Gene Shepard.
Ooh.
Material from 1958.
If you don't know, if you listeners do not know who Gene Shepard is, you're in for a treat. Gene Shepard is he after whom storytelling radio is based. I don't think he's ever been equaled.
And you know, interestingly enough, on these new programs, he doesn't do a whole lot of storytelling. It's almost like improvisational jazz, what he was doing in his early days in New York.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, I would say that.
A couple of stories woven in, but a lot of it is just free-form reflections on life in New York.
So, again, when will that be broadcast, Max?
That's this Sunday at 7 o'clock until 11.
Okay, very
shoving
good.
Shoving Dave Kenny aside,
ah,
as they like to do during fun drives.
Oh, he's had a couple of specials this drive, hasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, it's to each their own, and to us, the
and
Ray
hopefully,
Bradbury.
By the time I come in on Sunday, they'll fix the air conditioner again.
Yeah, oh, God, this
third
is...
time it's gone out this month.
Well, this month isn't over yet, but it was out for at least 2 weeks in June.
Well, that was the annual outage.
Oh.
It mysteriously went down a couple of weekends ago, and they got it fixed on Monday, which shocked the hell out of me, because nothing ever happens that fast.
Ah.
The AI.
Yeah, if people, by the way, wonder, let me just turn up the mic in here so you can all hear. Those are the fans. Those are my roaring fans in the background. And by the way, I suspect there will be a few people listening to this through the internet archives and all that. I noticed, for some reason, a boost in Google Plus and Twitter memberships to my feeds. Jim Freund on Twitter, by the way, JimFreund. And on Facebook, there is actually an Hour of the Wolf group that you can join, and a similar one on Google Plus. Although there you can just type in my name and you'll find the Hour of the Wolf group as well. And all of a sudden, all these people have joined on both Google Plus and Twitter, and I suspect that those people, because they get links, will be listening to this through the Internet Archive. So those people can call and pledge. And here is Antoinette with, oh my God, more money.
And while we get ready to read those some of the names and thank people, let me remind you as well that if you're listening perhaps over the Internet and don't want to make a phone call, or even if you're listening and, you know, on your radio and don't want to make a phone call, this is available at the BAI Pledge website called Give2WBAI, and that's spelled G-I-V-E, numeral 2. You don't write in numeral, it's just the number 2. Give2WBAI, and across the top you will see various sections, and all the way on the right is the miscellaneous section, which is where they stick all of the Golden Age of Radio premiums.
Yeah, Antoine, would you like to do these?
And for people just tuning in, by the way, we should point out that we're celebrating the works and life of Ray Bradbury on this extended Hour of the Wolf broadcast. So who have we got to thank?
I'm sorry, Max. Antoinette and I were talking business because she's basically all alone in that room. I was going to ask her if she wanted to read these names on the air, but she wants to be by the phones where we're hoping the action is. So
right.
21, in that case, I'm going to give the phone number, 212-209-2950. And in the meantime, we do want to thank Deborah in Brooklyn. I don't see that we can mention her name on the air, so I'm just going to mention her first name. So there's Deborah in Brooklyn. Oh, good God. Ben Zuhl in Maryland. Excuse me, not Maryland. He's going to kill me. Virginia. You know Ben?
The Zuhl of Zuhl fame?
That's the one.
Of course.
That's the one. He and Sigourney Weaver.
First name. I only knew him as Zuhl.
Did you realize?
He obeyed.
Yeah, well, he was around the station when you started working here. but nowadays he lives near Washington, D.C. for professional reasons.
Well, as I said while you were away for a moment, if you don't want to call or if you find that there are too many people trying to call, you can pledge online on the BAI Pledge website, give to WBAI.org. That's give numeral 2, WBAI.org. As in true hip-hop styly style, it's give number 2, WBAI.org.
And there,
in the miscellaneous section, you can find the drop-down where you'll see various Golden Age of Radio premiums, including the Ray Bradbury 2-disc set that we offer tonight for a mere $60 pledge. All of that money goes to support WBAI.
And none of which to recompense Max for, I don't know, the hundreds and hundreds of hours that it must have taken to put this together.
Not to mention the blank discs that I used to make them and the ink that I used to print them.
Well, those, for God's sake, Max, you should get the station to pay for.
I know, and lately they've been bootlegging my stuff.
Yeah.
They don't want to wait for me to bring it in. They've been bootlegging them at the station.
Yeah,
so... Of course, you don't get the same lovely artwork that I spent hours designing, but at least you get the premium that you pledge for. And yes, if you pledged for something, let's say 5 years ago, and perhaps you had difficulty getting it, those difficulties are over. I will say that our manager, Berthold Reimers, has been overly diligent.
He really is on top of it.
I mean, he duplicates and mails these things out himself.
I have come here in the middle of the night and found him, you know, doing clerical work to get premiums out. Which is, and at least he's starting to actually get volunteers to do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I have someone email me lately and say, you know, I never got the thing I pledged for, all I need to do is bring it to his attention, and it's taken care of.
Yeah, so he actually gets very upset when he hears that stuff.
It's a great waste of the manager's time, I must say, and I wish there was another way to do it, but I know that if I bring it to him, it will get done.
Yeah, on the one hand, it's a waste of his time. On the other hand, isn't it nice to know that he puts a priority on it?
Yes, and cares enough. So, you know, order with confidence, we say.
Indeed, yes. Something people couldn't always do before. We would also like to thank Mr. Stern in Queens. I'm not wearing my glasses. And Michael in the Bronx for their pledges. We so far have raised exactly 300 clams.
Okay, well, not a bad start.
Not a bad start, and I would like...
Double that before 3 o'clock rolls around. But, you know, I think it's time we played some actual... You know, give them a taste of what it is they're getting.
Yeah, some soft rains, perhaps.
Soft rains, I think, yes, is a good place to start.
So we'll start with that before we get to... And we'll fade it down at 0 hour. Does that sound right?
It's broken neatly into two halves, so...
Okay, so, Max, you stay on the phone. I'll just take your potentiometer down. I was going to say, Papa, people would misunderstand that. I'll lower your mic.
All right, what I may do, though, I may have to put the phone in the cradle to make sure it stays charged up.
That's probably a good idea.
All right.
And, you know, if you disconnect, we'll reconnect in a little while.
Yeah, I have two other phones, so if this one runs out, I guess I can find another one.
Go for the backup. I'm afraid to tell people how many little... I've got my phone, I've got my little portable phone, but I've also got my Nexus 7. Ooh, my first tablet ever. And it's only been out for 2 days now. So this is, like, way cool. So anyway, running Jelly Bean, if that means anything to anybody. Anyway, Jelly Beans aside and all that, this is WBAI in New York City. The program is Hour of the Wolf. I am Jim Freund, with me Max Schmid, and we are now going to continue our almost all night, our half night Bradbury fundraising special with one of the many, many, many radio dramas you will get if you subscribe with a $60 pledge at 212-209-2950. Is that breathless enough? There will come soft rains. That's if the player starts.
countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X minus one.
Can you predict the future? Can you tell what will come in 100 years? Or in 10? Or in the next minute? Tonight we present two ventures into the unknown. Two fantasies of the future, chosen from the works of one of our most brilliant young science fiction writers, Ray Bradbury. First, his story entitled, There Will Come Soft Rains. The house was a good house, planned and built to be lived in the year 1980. The real estate agent had told them all about it.
Now, this is the bedroom. Of course, it contains all the latest devices, self-warming blankets, and, there's a brand new feature. Beds, which make themselves. Now, if you'll just step this way through the library, we can see the latest in talking book recorders, self-building fireplace, self-cleaning robot dust disposal. Oh, these little mouse-like things come out of the wall and take away all the dirt. Now, over this way. As a complete robot kitchen, of course. Just set the menu for the week and the stove does the rest. Then there's the automatic hydroponic garden, self-sprinkling fire protection. See, the house is fully automatic. Well, you could go away for a year and it would run itself.
And so the family took the house, the man and the woman and the two children, a boy and a girl, and they lived contentedly, enjoying music and poetry and the rich, warm things in life. And the house fed them and slept them and entertained them. It made a good life for them. Until one day, there were 10,000 explosions, and the world shook, and red fire and ashes and radioactivity fell from the sky. The happy time was over.
Tick-tock, 7 o'clock, time to rise, open your eyes, tick-tock. 7 o'clock, time to rise, open your eyes.
But the house lay empty. The clock talked to the empty morning. In the kitchen, the stove sighed and ejected from its warm interior 8 eggs, sunny side up, 12 bacon slices, 2 coffees, and 2 cups of hot cocoa.
7-9, breakfast time, come and dine, 7-9.
Today is April 28th, 1985. Today, remember, is Mr. Featherstone's birthday. Insurance, gas, atom heat, and electricity bills are due.
In the walls, relays clicked, memory tapes glided under electric eyes, recorded voices moved beneath steel needles.
Eight o'clock.
But no doors slammed. No carpets took the quick tread of rubber heels. At 8:30, the eggs began to shrivel. An aluminum wedge scraped them into the sink.
9:15, time to clean. 9:15, time to clean.
Out of the wall, hundreds of tiny mechanical mice darted. The rooms were acrawl with small cleaning animals, all rubber and metal. They sucked up the hidden dust and dirt and popped back into their burrows. At 10 o'clock, the sun came out from behind the rain. The house stood alone on a street where all the other houses were rubble and ashes. At night, the ruined town gave off a radioactive glow which could be seen for miles. At 10:15, the garden sprinkler filled the soft morning air with golden fountains. The water tinkled over the charred west side of the house, the side which had been facing the blast. It was black, except in five places. One of the five places was a silhouette of a man mowing a lawn, just as he'd been the instant the radioactivity burned his image into the side of the house. Over there, a woman bent to pick flowers. Still further over, their images burned into the wood, were a small boy, hands flung into the air, higher up the image of a thrown ball, and opposite, a girl, her hands raised to catch a ball, which never came down. Five people. Five spots of paint. On the front porch, the dog whined and shivered. The front door recognized the dog's voice and opened. The dog padded in wearily, thin to the bone, covered with sores. It ran to the kitchen and pawed the kitchen door wildly. Behind the door, the stove was making pancakes, which filled the house with their odor, as prescribed by the automatic preset menu selector. The dog frogged, ran insanely, spun in a circle, biting its tail, and died.
1 o'clock, 1 o'clock.
Delicately sensing decay, the regiments of mice hummed out of the walls, soft as blown leaves, their electric eyes glowing.
1:15.
The dog was gone.
2:15.
Bridge tables unfolded from the walls of the patio. Playing cards fluttered onto pads. Martinis appeared on an oaken bench. But the tables were silent. The cards untouched.
5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock.
Dinner was made, ignored, flushed away. Dishes were washed. In the study, the tobacco stand produced a cigar with half an inch of gray ash upon it, smoking, waiting, waiting. The hearth fire bloomed out of nothing.
9 o'clock, 9 o'clock.
The beds began to warm their hidden circuits, and the phonograph spoke from beside the fireplace.
Mrs. McClelland, what poem would you like to hear this evening? Mr. McClelland? Since you express no preference, I shall select at random from among your favorites. Sarah Teasdale, There Will Come Soft Rains.
There will come soft rains and the smell of the ground, and swallows circling with their shimmering sound, and frogs in the pools singing at night, and wild plum trees in tremulous white. Robins will wear their feathery fire, whistling their whims on a low fence wire. And not one will know of war. Not one will care at last when it is done. Not one would mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly. And spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone.
The phonograph finished the poem. The empty chairs faced each other between the silent walls. At 10 o'clock that evening, the house began to die. The wind blew the bough of a falling tree into the kitchen window, smashing it. A bottle of cleaning fluid crashed on the stove. Water pumps shot down from the ceiling, but the solvent spread onto the doors, making fire as it went, other voices in other rooms taking up the alarm.
Help! 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 Help!
The windows broke with the heat and the wind blew in to help the fire. The fire crackled upstairs at paintings, lay hungrily on the beds, devoured the rooms. The house began to shudder. The bared skeleton began to cringe in the heat. The wires revealed as if a surgeon had torn the skin off. Voices screamed in every room. Windows snapped open and shut like undecided mouths.
The time is now 10:10. The time is now 10:10. Run.
A thousand things were happening at once, like the interior of a clock shop at midnight. All the clocks were striking, making a merry-go-round of squeaking, whispering, and rushing. In the kitchen, the stove hissing hysterically was making breakfasts at a psychopathic rate. 10 dozen pancakes, 6 dozen loaves of toast. Then, there was silence. The film spools were burned out. The wires withered and the circuits cracked. Then the house began to breathe its last. The beams began to give at the foundations. Long cracks appeared in the concrete. The seams were burst from the heat. And finally, with a huge rumble, it crashed into dust and rubble. Dawn shone faintly in the east. In the ruins of the house, only one wall remained standing. And within the wall, even as the sun rose to shine upon the burning rubble, a voice spoke again and again and again.
No one would mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly. And spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone. That we were gone. That we were gone. That we were gone.
Today is April 29th, 1985.
Strange are the uses of Providence. Is this how the end will come for mankind, with 10,000 explosions and a flash of radioactive gas? Or will destruction come more subtly, extended to us gently and innocently in, oh, let's say, the hand of a child?
I think we will take our pause there. That was the beginning of Zero Hour, wasn't it?
Yes, and what we've been listening to, actually, even though it was broadcast on X-1 on December 5th of 1956, it was clearly a rebroadcast of the Dimension X original broadcast from 1950, because that narrator was the great Norman Rose.
Mm.
Boy, what a year 1985 was, all those conveniences.
Yes, exactly. I've always loved the retro future. As it were, the future retro, days of future past, the how in 1939 at the World's Fair they predicted 1989, you know, 50 years into the future, and how in 1969 we saw 2001, and for that, and 5 years later, 2010, at least in the book. And Bradbury was writing about the far, far future of 1980 through 1985.
With magnetic tapes controlling everything.
Yes.
Except a needle that drops on Sarah Teasdale.
Yeah, right. Not, but, you know, magnetic tapes. Well, think about the strip cards in the back of your Metro card and all that stuff. Actually, not that far off. Not that Bradbury could have cared less. If he was accurate or not. He just wanted to tell his stories.
Yes, well, he certainly predicted our nuclear destruction, which is still, you know, an imminent possibility.
And given, yeah, and given the time when he was writing it, was the worry of the score, not the decade, but for the 20 years, he's basically foreseeing the Cold War.
And that, by the way, I should point out, is merely half of one episode of the dozens of radio episodes that you get on our Pledge Drive thank you gift, our premium for this program. Is a two-disc set of the radio works of Ray Bradbury that includes, let's back up here to the folder, 9 miscellaneous series, 8 episodes of Dimension X, 10 episodes of Suspense, a 2.5-hour compilation of The Martian Chronicles, culled from a number of different series, 7 episodes of X-1. Also rounding out that disc is a Gene Shepard program looking back at Fahrenheit 451. That's just disc one called Old Time Radio.
Not to mention an interview that we rebroadcast earlier tonight of me and Ray Bradbury.
I maybe get shifted over to disc two.
Okay.
But be that as it may, on disc two, we have more modern works that fall after Old Time Radio, and many of these are in stereo and brilliant productions. You get a 4-part Dandelion Wine adaptation. You get a dozen short stories in stereo. You get something called Golden Apples of the Sun, another 2-hour adaptation of a different book by Ray Bradbury.
A different collection of stories.
Yes, 10 miscellaneous readings by the likes of Burgess Meredith and Leonard Nimoy and others. You get the 90-minute adaptation of the motion picture Something Wicked This Way Comes, a full 90-minute radio production, because along with the movie soundtrack, they added narration by Orson Welles, who reads the prose of Ray Bradbury to make it into a radio piece.
Yeah, it basically gives it the continuity for the story. It was written to be a screenplay originally. Before it was ever a book, it was a screenplay. And they use all that vocal work with Jason Robards and others and Orson Welles doing the linkage.
And not only do you get American shows, you get South African radio from 1968, you get Canadian radio from spanning decades, and even some British radio. All of this, 42-plus hours, and plus some interviews that we've only recently discovered that are going to be added in, space permitting, all of this on 2 MP3 discs for a $60 pledge to WBAI.
And we're seeking some more materials, I should mention. I've sent out emails to some extremely famous writers who have done homages to Bradbury in the last 6 weeks. So we'll see how, if any of those can fit in, or if we'll have a very special little streaming website just for those people who call now at area code 212-209-2950 to pledge the $60 that Max mentioned.
And, you know, BAI is going through some very rough times, as is the entire Pacifica network that owns WBAI and 4 other stations around the country.
And, BAI, it's perennially in trouble. But we're at a point now where the whole Pacifica chain, the foundation itself, we're being shaken to our very foundation, literally. There were times in the past when one of the stations was in trouble. Perhaps the foundation could come in, loan the money, and get us out. But now, this is network-wide.
So, and that's why I don't take a penny from the station to produce it. I actually produce these myself, duplicate them myself with my own materials. So
it's actually
every
costing
penny of that $60 is going to WBAI.
And it's not it's happening on Max's own dime. And he is unpaid. I am unpaid. We are doing this for the love of a unique radio station, WBAI New York. Oh, that's twice I got breaks in the right time.
For the sake of clarity, I am unpaid as my production capacity is for the station.
That's right. You actually
I do get paid to do 2 jobs at the same time in certain overnights during the week.
Right, as part of the operations department. But you're not actually paid for your programming.
No, that's all extra.
Exactly. And the programming, the golden age of radio, is a unique thing. Hour of the Wolf is unique. Earthwatch is unique. Radio Unnameable is as unique as one can get. All the literary and arts programs on the station, which are the ones that I like to promote, but are hardly the totality of WBAI. Sometimes it's the minority. Sometimes one can only hope that it will make a major comeback, and I think it might if we survive. And that's a very real if at this point. I know that, you know, I've cried Hour of the Wolf many times. But
if you walk at the Internet, you'll find articles about how tough things are around here. We're going through a $1 million network-wide reduction in expenses, which have already had some very sad and unfortunate consequences, I should say.
And we've already gone through a series of draconian cuts. Several years ago, our arts department was eliminated. And
along with a fifth of my salary.
That's right. That's right.
I do get paid, but I get paid at a reduced rate.
So, and now essential administrative positions have been eliminated as well, Pacifica-wide.
And so, that's why we come on the air too many times a year, for too many days and months at a time, to ask our listeners to please help us pay for the expenses. And our BAI, maybe foolishly, will not accept underwriting. We have no corporate sponsorship. Our entire funding, besides some CPB grant money, comes from our listeners who want to see us succeed and stay on the air fighting the good fight.
We are not listener-supported radio. You know, there's a fine line between us and public radio, which we are not, by the way. I met our new program director, and he did not realize that we are not actually public radio. We're a private foundation run out of out of California that owns and operates five radio stations around the country, of which, well, we believe we are the between us and KPFA, we are the flagship stations.
Well, we certainly have the potentially largest audience, which we failed to reach for whatever reason, lack of advertising budget, lack of outreach, but here we are in the biggest radio market in the world.
With 50,000 watts, we are at 99.5 FM. This is not, you know, like 81.0.
Yes, you can actually receive our signal.
For quite a distance, as a matter of fact. And in this, you know, the best market, and one of the largest markets in the world, we need to make listener-sponsored radio succeed. The idea, as envisioned by Lou Hill in 1947, 8, whatever, was the concept of the person behind the microphone is the one who thinks up the things to say instead of just a script. And even if there is a script, it's the person behind the mic who would do the script. That was point number two. Point number one was that educational radio, which at the time was terribly threatened. It was originally all radio was to be non-commercial for the most part, and a little portion of it would be commercial, and of course it got reversed. And to those ends, he created the idea of listener-sponsored radio. It all began with Pacifica, which is, by the way, a neighborhood in San Francisco, in the San Francisco Berkeley area. That's where we get our name from. It's also, by the way, important to remember, where Starfleet is located. I always like to throw that one out, but you know, a few science fiction fans will say Pacifica, like, you know, Starfleet, and it's like, no, but yeah, I mean, it's California, it's that part of California, indeed.
A couple of years ago, I think they named the car Pacifica as well.
There is a Pacifica car. There are whole bunches of things named Pacifica, none of which have anything to do with us, but we are the one true Pacifica. We are listener-sponsored radio. When you give us a dollar, we get a dollar. Those funds are not matched by corporations, by the government, by this or that. Our budget is, what is it, Max? You would know better than I. Is it overnight?
Oh, it's in the $3 million range.
Yeah.
$3.5 million, perhaps.
And of
which we bring in about 2.8 of that every year.
Yeah, and we have to make up that shortfall. And, by the way, one person is calling and pledging right now. And of that annual budget, how much of that comes from listener sponsorship?
Oh, well, the CPB grant is the only other money that we get. We did just get a grant from some New York City agency.
We got some small grants for capital purposes.
Yes.
To pay certain bills. They don't underwrite programs. They don't go for salaries for people. They go to pay for equipment or to pay our usage of music on the air, to pay BMI, ASCAP, and Sound Exchange.
And we have to pay Democracy Now! And Free Speech Radio News. Those are some of our radio expenses.
At least, and Democracy Now! Actually originated from this radio station. Broke off into its own entity, and we have to chip in for the expenses of that show.
Now just think of BAI Radio as a nightmare of your own home budget. We have to pay the rent, not just in our studios, but we also have to pay for a tiny little room on the top of the Empire State Building on the 86th floor.
Where our transmitter.
A closet that houses our transmitter so that we have the reach of 50,000 watts of power from the top of the Empire State Building. But that room is it close to $1 million? I'm probably exaggerating, but it's a very expensive.
I think it's about, I think it's near $400,000 a year.
And you know,
and that really, with our rent here, that comes to $1 million.
Yeah. So, and there's no way around that expense, because if we're not transmitting from the Empire State Building, basically, our signal would reach only half the number of people that it reaches now.
Much less than half. Much less than half.
And unfortunately, very few of those people even tune in, let alone become listener sponsors. So we're asking now, if you live for Hour of the Wolf every week at this strange new hour of 1:30 in the morning.
It's a manufactured time slot. They actually had to take time away from two other radio shows to eck me in after 39 years of 5 to 7 a.m.
Well,
it was supposed to be transitional.
Hour of the Wolf, you're the person now who needs to call 212-209-2950. According to our bylaws that are currently in place, the minimum pledge amount to become a full year member is $25, only $25.
Yeah, it used to be $45.
But we are sweetening the pot tonight. We want to give you something back. And for what I consider a very reasonable price of $60, we have for you this 2 MP3 disc collection of Ray Bradbury material, over 20 hours on the old time radio, disc 1, and over 20 hours on disc 2, which is modern radio drama, adaptations, interviews, readings of the works of Ray Bradbury.
And
$60, you can get it now by calling 212-209-2950. Hopefully, before this night is over, we'll bring you another, maybe full half-hour broadcast, or at least another sample of the sort of material you're getting. I think There Will Come Soft Rains was a very good example of radio at its finest. The prose of Ray Bradbury, I'm sure they didn't amend it much, in this version at least. Great sound effect, tape loops. Oh, I don't know if they had tape too long before that show was originally produced.
Certainly not in the way that we have it now. I don't know that they did.
No, the magnetic recording was stolen from the Germans when we marched onto Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
A fellow named Irish, which accounts for all the Irish and Shamrock brands of tape.
Ah.
He is the guy who grabbed the machine and rebuilt it in our country, and the first person to use it in the United States was Bing Crosby, who, you know, was not always happy with some of his vocal performances and wanted to have a way to clean up his broadcast before they went on the air.
Mm.
Before that, it was forbidden to use recordings on the radio. except in rare exceptions, for transcribed programming, which was recorded on giant 16-inch phonograph records. But Crosby was the first person to bring tape recording into radio, and it took off from there.
And thanks to Der Bingle's technologies, we are here to bring you the works of Der Bradbury.
But 212-209-2950.
Every time I say something inane, Max will properly fill in with the phone number. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to pledge your support for WBAI, for Hour of the Wolf, for the Golden Age of Radio, and to commemorate the only station that I'm aware of that has turned over all this airtime to Bradbury. This is actually the third show I am doing. I've done two 90-minute shows on Bradbury already, most of which were just content, just radio drama or whatever, including the one with the discussion with James Gates and Felix Gilman, a fine writer himself. I'm afraid that Bradbury's death sort of threw a curve to that particular show. On the other hand, it gave us a lot to talk about. There is nobody, but nobody, in the science fiction fantasy fields who do not recognize what they owe to Ray Bradbury. And in return, Max Schmid has produced, again, I don't know how many hundreds of hours have gone into this production of this premium. I mean, I'm not really exaggerating there, am I?
No, I put more effort into some of these premiums than I do into some of my broadcasts.
Yeah, I mean, I know that the recovery of the interview that we played earlier tonight that I did with Bradbury when he won the National Book Award in 2000, the recovery of that audio alone was, what, about 5 hours of your work or more?
Probably.
Yeah. Yeah,
and let me thank Jerry Handig as well for, you know, his generosity. He is a major old-time radio collector from the West Coast. He has perhaps the most expansive collection of old-time radio in the country, if not the world, and makes it available. And I just asked him, I said, Jerry, can I use some of this stuff? Back during the birthday celebration a year and a half ago, I went to Jerry and said, can I use some of this stuff on our premium and for broadcast? And he graciously allowed us to do that.
Yeah, and it's really a wonderful thing. And this is what it takes. There is a community of people that recognize, A, the radio contributions, B, Bradbury's contributions, and all of these come together so you can make a contribution. Did I do that well?
By calling 212-209-2950. Is anyone calling now?
Yes, one person is in fact calling now.
Well, slow and steady wins the race.
Indeed.
Turtle once told me.
Indeed. And by a hair, if we can get a couple more calls in. Okay, I think that one just finished. And another call seems to be coming in. 212-209-2950. I am hopeful that this is a good thing. If we can get a couple more calls before, in the next 10 minutes, that would bring us to 224. You know, before 225, I would say, good, let's play a whole half hour. We'll be done with the pitching for the night. We'll say thank you, Max, and thank you, listeners, for a job well done. And we'll go out on the roar of a rocket and a radio drama. And those who want the well over 40 hours of interview and talk and this ongoing amazing production, still in production, of the Ray Bradbury WBAI Premium. They called it, for some reason, the best of Bradbury. It's not. It's the I would call it the comprehensive Bradbury.
Yeah, I think I called it that. But, you know, we got to call it something.
Okay.
Why not call it the best? Because, I mean, it's not just the best, it's all. I mean, this is everything I could find and, you know, scouring one archive after another.
Therefore,
and
my
then
use
I took
of the...
all the results of that scouring and condensed the best sounding copies because, you know, there are multiple copies of many of these things. Then again, some of these I found in terribly obscure places and brought it all together to celebrate. You know, I've been saying his 80th birthday. It was his 90th birthday.
It was his 90th, yeah. He died at age 91.
So even if you, I don't know if people want to pledge for an upgraded version if they already got this. We did offer this a year and a half ago. But this current copy will be newly revised and upgraded. I've discovered sources.
Ooh.
Yes.
I turned around, and we now have a tally of 470.
Well, you know, this could be historic, because I've been looking through the tally book, which is where we record the results from every broadcast during our fun drive, and the overnights have just been dead.
And this is certainly...
It could be part of history if you pledge now. This could be the biggest night of the summer fun drive of 2012.
Yes, yes, indeed. Pop a cork and make a pledge. 212-209-2950. Antoinette is the sole person right now in the tally room taking calls, but she is at the ready right now. No calls are coming in. There was the one call that was coming in. Now I'm getting a on-the-air call, but we're not doing that, I'm afraid. I suspect that was the person who called there before. But we're in the business of fundraising this morning. And besides, I don't trust this system to conference call. 2 weeks ago when I had David Brin, the great David Brin, who wrote a very nice remembrance of Bradbury, by the way. I had him on, and everything was going fine, only when I was taking phone calls. Then 3 minutes before the end of the show, bing, or derbingle, I lost him on the air.
Here's a tip. For all the interns who might be listening, and even producers who might be listening, if you see on the phone, there's a button that says conference that needs to be read in order to take multiple phone calls.
No, I was doing that. I had taken two calls in a row. The third one is where I somehow...
Well, but we do have people who like to disrupt the normal functioning of our system. There's another button there that says, I forget, the one on the right of
next.
If you lock that down, then I cannot be hung up on until you unlock that, because I forget what it's called, but... It locks in, I'm calling on line 6, I believe, and it locks that line in.
Yeah, don't give people that special information.
No, I'm not giving them the number. I'm just saying where you see me on that phone.
Yeah, by the way, we do have more people that we can thank at this point.
Oh, good.
Including a Mr. Jefferson in Laurelton. Which is in Queens, unless I'm mistaken. Robert in Manhattan, Midtown Manhattan, and from Brooklyn, Canada. No, from Brooklyn, Canada. a person who's been pledging to Hour of the Wolf for I don't know how many years, over a score. John Gladstone Gilman, and thank you very much.
You know, speaking of our neighbors to the north, they recently shut down all of their radio dramas.
Yes! At ReaderCon, a science fiction convention I attended this past weekend, some Canadians were there and told me that in their budget overhaul, they just cut the all radio drama from the CBC.
Now, at least in England, you know, it's a great training ground for actors, people... would just as soon do radio as they would do a television series in England, but, you know, that's government-sponsored, state-sponsored broadcasting.
Yeah, but people, they still have to have the license, and Parliament can come down on the Board of Governors. They have issues there as well.
Well, you know how bad it got at the BBC? They had put together, you're familiar as a radio producer, with the BBC Sound Effects Library.
Oh, the Radiophonic Workshop.
They started charging their own producers to use for using sound effects from the BBC
Library.
Oh,
my God.
That's how bad it got in England and may still be.
Yeah, indeed. Well, you know, the science fiction stuff in England is actually a lot of what is helping keep the Beeb together. I mean,
oh, you know,
Doctor Who is huge now.
You know, there's a new Hitchhiker series starting any day now on the radio.
Another one.
Yes.
I knew that they were planning multiple ones. I have to say I was a little, well, disappointed in Series 4, I think it was.
Well, Simon Jones just reported that he did another one. And I forget when it launches. Sometime this month, I think. Just heard that word.
I mean, the problem was not that it was bad, but that it was all about cricket. And so it had a limited, you know... appeal.
It only appealed to the Commonwealth countries, eh?
Yes, basically.
It's kind of like the sports cast on the Al Jazeera newscast coming up at 5:30. Actually, on BAI, we don't get the cricket news is only in the hour-long version that we used to carry. Now we carry the half hour without sports.
Yeah, but I mean, Brits have their cricket obsession. Tom Stoppard wrote plays about it and all that. And, of course, in England, which is the, you know, where Hitchhikers is originally produced, they celebrated that fact. But nowadays, I would hope that they are taking a more international view, given how successful, for example, Doctor Who has been in the U.S. and to a...
to the point that they shot the last season, or at least an episode or two.
Two episodes.
In the United States.
There's a Western episode and there's a New York episode that were actually filmed here.
Entirely or just the exteriors, I'm suspecting?
Just the exteriors,
yeah,
of
I
course.
Think they did the White House from some soundstage in England.
Oh, yeah, they rebuilt the Oval. I mean, they never show the outside. It just, you know, they built the Oval Office. One would imagine that there is a template somewhere for, okay, we need an Oval Office, and, you know, they just have to, okay, go into warehouse number 2, and you'll find it in there, but apparently not. Apparently they had to build the Oval Office for Doctor Who. Very strange, very strange. Now,
while we're on this tangent, let me just say that if we just watched the final episode of Eureka, and goodbye to that wonderful series.
Oh, did they finally do the very last one?
Monday was the last episode, and I just watched it while this show was actually on.
Nah.
The last episode.
Yeah. I'm catching up with the entire thing through time delay.
They brought back... Oh, I shouldn't say, should I? Spoiler.
I can...
They brought back most of the characters who appeared throughout the series, including one from a wonderful... Cylon-infested series that we love.
Yeah, of course. Did Will Wheaton make it through to the end?
What's that?
Will Wheaton.
Yes, he was. They prominently featured everyone in the last episode.
Okay, very good. I mean, they only brought him in, you know, like the very last legs of the series.
Well, he also appears regularly on, the comedy show I can never remember the name of.
Oh, that one.
Where he plays himself as the nemesis of the brilliant but eccentric doctor.
Ah.
You know the show I'm talking about. What's the name of that show, Anne-Marie? Is Anne-Marie listening? She's 7 second delay, so if she is...
Then she'll answer in 7 seconds. There we go, yeah. But indeed, she's in the other room, I take it.
Yes. At the radio very low.
At Schmiedco Studios.
Yeah, Thursday at 8. You know the show I'm talking about. I'm sure everyone does.
You know, I don't. I don't watch that much American
TV. Big Bang Theory.
Oh, you know, everybody's always astonished that I've never seen that show. And what will happen, the way I do these things, is I'll probably see the entire series, in one, like an episode a night until, you know, from beginning to end. That's how I watch a lot of these things.
Yes, well, when you catch the bug, you'll want to see it.
Oh, no doubt. It will happen, but, you know, recently...
I think it's more geared for geeks and Comic-Con types than perhaps the literary types of... But it's funny, you know, background in comic book fandom or Dungeons and Dragons, you appreciate it.
I can't tell you how at ReaderCon, so many people were, you know, ReaderCon was opposite Comic-Con on two opposite coasts, and there were people saying, gee, if I could have only gotten into that Joss Whedon panel for a minute.
I would have given them what for.
Yeah, exactly. No, I don't think so. I think they would have given them anything.
Given them their pants.
Yes.
And all we ask is $60 for this wonderful Ray Bradbury premium.
Which is probably the cost of a pair of cheap pants today. It is now $225, and, you know, I don't know if we should give up at this point before making $500.
Well, I'm just looking at some of the options that we have. Pedestrian is 25 minutes or 26 minutes.
Mm.
The South African show is 25.
Mm-hmm. Remember, I have to play my outro, which is 3 minutes.
And we need to, you know, like give it one rousing last push. But, you know, if anyone would like to call now,
we can then
we're on the verge of a record for at least this fund drive in the overnight, if we haven't already made it. But, you know, there's never enough money at WBAI, so we call on everyone listening.
So
even if you're already a member, I think that this package for $60 is so worthy of your attention and support that I urge you to go to the phone, call 212-209-2950, and get yourself a copy of The Best of Bradbury, as we called it, for lack of something better.
I'm just nitpicking.
Well, 212-209-2950. We have to start producing these things and actually turn them in.
Yeah, 212-209-2950. It is 2:26 and a half in New York City. If we can get a couple more calls, hey, how about all you people actually listening live through the internet? Give us a call, 212-209-2950.
And if you're just too tired to go to the phone right now and you want to pledge tomorrow, and we're not offering this, well, it's online. You can pledge for it online at the website called give2wbai.org in the miscellaneous section. This premium is available for online ordering, so you can get it that way as well if you can't make a phone call right now for whatever reason.
So if you're listening in the future, you can donate in the past.
Well, that's true. You know, I know many people listen to the Golden Age of Radio online after it's been broadcast.
Absolutely. I can even name some good apps that find it.
DAR FM?
DAR FM is not bad. It has finally started working for me, and I'm going to probably start putting links to it. But I use TuneIn Radio.
Okay.
Which works very nicely, and it's available on just on every platform out there.
And also, of course, there's the WBAI archives at our website, WBAI.org. Did you escape the arts curse of 2 week minimum?
No. I have not escaped that at all, and I really ought to.
Because I noticed
if the show before me that plays a lot of music,
yeah,
is allowed to be downloaded, why not mine?
And I agree, mine too. I mean, no one's contesting any copyrights for the Golden Age of Radio that I'm aware of. At least, you know, not without permission. So, I mean, I see no reason why my show is limited to 2 weeks in the archives. But, you know, I need to talk to the new webmaster, perhaps.
Well,
we have a brand new website, by the way. How do you enjoy our new website?
It needs proofreading.
Well, yes. And it needs some updating.
It needs some updating. It needs proofreading. I have just been assigned...
I'm in the music department.
An intern. I've been assigned an intern who sent me an
email.
No, I got James.
Oh, okay. I believe mine is named Kamali, and I said, look,
you know,
I don't know what I'm doing 48 hours before the show, so there's no way I can comply with your request.
Yeah, exactly. That's the problem. They don't, you know, it's like, what is my playlist? Well, I know my intro, and I know my outro, but I cannot say what the in-between shows are. I do not know at this moment what I will be playing the next. It's called Freeform Radio. And I know listeners may be requesting that, but they can keep on requesting it because I don't know.
They try to put us in a box, Jim.
Yeah.
They try to put us in a box. We can't be boxed. We're artists.
Indeed, indeed. And by the way, you know, speaking of Star Trek and stuff like that, so all I can think of are these interns that say, I am for you, James Kirk. You know, or... something along that you remember the episode, I trust, that I'm talking
about.
Yes, you know. So it's like, I am for you. I am James, Jim. And I have yet to get back to him. But yeah, 48 hours, I often don't know. It's like, oh my God, somebody just flew into town. I'm going to have a great guest. And, well, you know, I'll just be using Twitter and Facebook and all, and Google Plus and all those means to publicize.
Well, you know, I'm told that eventually our the BAI website will link to our Facebook announce pages. It can be updated through that system.
Well, you know what?
Point in the future.
I have news for you. It already did. My Twitter feed was available on the old WBAI website with links to the Hour of the Wolf group and the others on Facebook. So you know what? It was already there.
Well, I got to convince them to put me back in the arts department and take me out of the music. I don't play any music on my program.
Yeah, well, I'm in the arts department and I do play a little bit of music. But even so, but I play less music than a lot of public affairs shows on this station.
Well, I won't name them, but, you know, shows using, I'm not going into technical.
No, I don't want. I don't want to spoil it for others. It's just it's been spoiled for me. And let's not even get into a conversation that I had with our program director, who understood it so well. I didn't have to have it. Two magic words: safe harbor.
Ah, yes, indeed.
Where
James Joyce fans, maybe this is a good place on a literary program to support our Bloomsday efforts that took place in June. I was called in to engineer again this year because apparently they trust no one else to push buttons on recordings of great celebrities from Broadway and television.
I saw the little off Broadway production with Simon Lokely hosting the ceremonies downtown. It was tremendous fun. Both Bloomsdays were very good. So I started the day over at the Ulysses Pub with Simon Lokely presiding. And
we'll be on at 6 o'clock on Saturday morning, by the way, for an extra hour featuring some great jazz music.
Indeed, in half of my former time slot. And then I went home and I listened to our production at Symphony Space. One more call came in, by the way. I don't know if it were a pledge or not, but it was on long enough. So with any luck, we will be tipping over the $500 mark for this morning, which is very
good. Well, you know,
good.
We had 300 at 1:30 when your show actually started. I think we should be able to double that. I think we should at least set aside of $600 for this program.
I think
that's
so.
Only $200 an hour, which isn't enough to run the radio station.
It really isn't, and we're only asking $60 for, 40 plus hours of incredible radio.
However, if you're one of those listeners who hates Ray Bradbury, you can become a member for only $25.
There is that.
And continue to torture yourself listening to this program.
Exactly. But I don't. Ooh, okay, we just jumped. Ooh. It is now $530.
Oh, we need $70.
Yeah, $60 and a $10 gift. $60 with a $10 gimme would do it. 212-209-2950. But then what could I play, Max? Is there anything else that's short, or should we continue with Zero Hour?
We could do the little short, the Zero Hour, or let me look.
Because I still have that queued up. I never took my finger off the pulse of that.
All of these Golden Apples of the Sun shows seem to be 15-minute, you know, there are two shows per half hour, two stories per half hour.
Any reason not to do Zero Hour?
I don't know. That's the only problem. I don't know the source of Golden Apples of the Sun.
Ah, okay, so we might as well, you know, if we can get a couple more pledges in.
But it's 2:30 in the morning. Who's really paying any attention?
Oh, there's people out there. I know there are people out there. If I looked at the internet stream, I could probably find out how many there are.
Have a look. Now, remember, it's capital N these days. They changed it.
Okay, so it's .org, right?
On the right-hand computer. No, the left-hand computer.
I'm on the right-hand. Okay.
Okay, so on the left-hand computer, it's across the bookmark strip across the top.
Ah, okay. Very good.
We can see how many people are listening. Yes, technology on the move. How many people are listening to WBAI's stream as we broadcast now? Did you find it?
No.
I updated it yesterday with the correct spelling.
On which browser?
On the Firefox browser.
On Firefox, yeah.
On the, what is that, bookmark, highlighted bookmark strip that runs across the top.
Yeah, it's called the bookmark strip. I see Copyright Confessor, Democracy Now, Calendar.
Oh, maybe it's in the drop-down bookmarks.
Okay, let me go to the right.
Streaming now, I think it's called. In the meantime, though, while we take care of a little behind-the-scenes station business, let me remind people, we are asking for your calls of support to keep Hour of the Wolf alive and thriving and to keep the radio station that brings it to you, this WBAI New York, since 1960, a member of the Pacifica Foundation, a member of the Pacifica Network of five stations across the country dedicated to truth, justice, and peace. 212.
And the American way.
209-2950.
At least our interpretation of it.
Yes.
Okay. I found it as an often used link. So right now, over the internet alone, to this one stream, there are 97 listeners, and that doesn't count people that are listening through different applications and smartphones.
That's 30 more than is average for this time of night.
Actually, that's true. That's a pretty good number.
You know, usually dead, no one listening is 60.
Yeah, after 2 a.m. is usually considered the death shift. But, yeah, I mean, 97 people at this time ain't bad. I'm well aware of that. And
those folks can pledge online, or they can, you know, get off their duffs and make a phone call.
Well, one person is doing that right now, he said, turning over to the computer on his left. There is one call currently coming in. And it's sticking to it, so I have every reason to believe that Antoinette would not suffer fools gladly, and that's a real pledge. So if it's 70...
Oh, so we're probably $10 shy of making a $600 figure.
Unless that person is really, you know, so nice they'll give us that extra $10, but we don't know that.
We
need one more call.
Get that snappy new BAI t-shirt along
Ooh.
With your brand.
You know, see, I'm the only one who likes that shirt.
I kind of like it.
I just...
You know, it's a little...
What, well-designed?
That's the wrong word.
And people say it's corporate. I think, hey, it looks professional, for
you know,
God's sake.
I wore it one night while I was engineering other programs, and everyone said, how do I get one of those?
Absolutely.
I said, you know, I pledge $60. That's the only way I know that you can get one.
Yeah, well, Berthold promised me one, and then we didn't have any in the closet.
Yeah, well, we had a discussion. I think the staff may be able to get them soon for cost.
Yeah, really. I mean,
we get a few of them out there, but, you know, a few listeners would like one. It's a $60 donation to the station. And
so
a
for $120,
shirt.
You could get a shirt and the Bradbury Premium.
Yeah, why not? Radio for the 99%, I believe, is what it says across the back.
Yeah, yeah. And the, I have to say, I like the new logo.
It's a lovely shirt.
Yeah, it's really well done.
If you have every other BAI shirt, from the Sydney Smith designs to... You know, the old Gorin shirts.
Yeah, the Ed Gorin shirts are still my favorite.
You know, I still have, unfortunately I can't wear it because it's a size large,
yeah.
But I have the psychedelic ball.
Okay, you were right, Max. We're $10 shy. We got 590 in the till.
And you know, ordinarily, Jim would be bringing you interviews with authors and readings. Tonight... This is the time set aside for raising money to keep the station alive so that he can have the luxury of doing that.
Yeah, August is going to be hopping, by the way. I cannot begin to tell you how many...
Why don't you try to begin to tell
Okay, okay. Because it's off the top of my head. I can tell you that horror writer Michael Sisko, he's not just a writer, he's an instructor. He teaches imaginative literature and Gothic and stuff. I have a lot of academics on the show who are also writers, and Michael Sisko has a new novel out, is one of the best of them, and he was actually initially going to be on tonight till we realized that this was going to be a fundraising night, so we'll be moving him in August. Cherie Renee Thomas, I have very good reason to believe, she who created the Dark Matter series of books of science fiction from the African diaspora should be in New York. If she is, she's not being allowed out of New York without coming here to do a show. She's utterly wonderful. Oh my God, is that really? Okay, so somebody who called earlier is calling again, it would seem. It can't be a secondary pledge. I wonder if it's that person adding. This is that person in Virginia adding $10 or something like that. It's really weird that I can actually
see who's calling.
Yeah.
Well, except if they're, you know, a lot of them just show up as wireless caller. Oh.
Yes, but no, this had an actual name to it, a name that I dare not speak. The person who called and pledged earlier is that person's husband.
Ah.
In fact, and I happen to know she's likely not in the country at this moment. Okay, yeah. And the call is already gone.
A quick question.
Yeah.
How much time is left on that episode that we started to listen to before?
By the way, that was a $10 pledge.
All right. How long is that 0 hour that remains on that?
Let me find that tab on this computer. There is, well, we're 13 minutes into a 29-minute thing.
That pushes us right up to the end of the show, doesn't
it? It really does, but...
Oh, I wish I had thought of,
Well, wait a minute, so that leaves us, 30 minus 13 is 17, right? And it's now 2:42, 2:59. Yeah,
we're a little tight.
Yeah, just a wee bit tight. And God knows, Gary Null has to start on time.
Is it Gary now?
It's a record.
You don't get Lister. Lister is not on tonight.
No, Lister is not. Originally, I wasn't going to be on tonight. I requested it for this special show, and I was granted it by the powers that be. So. I could play a Bradbury song.
I'm checking. You mean the one that there's a censored version of?
No. That would be good, too. There is actually a censored version of it, isn't there?
Yeah, but it's censored to remove some references. I noticed I played it, and the key word was still there.
You're kidding me.
No, it was censored for people who complained. I forget. You have to look at it. But if you look at the censored version, you'll see in the notes why it was censored, and it isn't for the language.
It has to do with a book title, or Vonnegut, or what?
I forget. I saw it yesterday.
Well, anybody who wants to see the uncensored version, you go to YouTube, and you type in F me, except you don't use the F, you spell it out, F me Ray Bradbury.
Fine woman, do you remember her name?
Rachel Bloom. I remember her name well.
Brilliant song.
And here's Antoinette with the news of the day. Don't go far. I'll give them all to you at once. I'll read these names right now, and I'll let you know if anybody calls. But I knew without looking that Ben Zuhl had called for that $10. I knew it would be him because talk about invasion of privacy. I can see the names of people calling. It's really wrong. And
The power of radio.
A person from Pelham, New York, definitely needs to be thanked.
My old stomping ground.
Yes, indeed.
No,
don't stomp on the listeners, Max.
When I was a lad.
And Pamela calling in from the Bronx. And all of these people need to be thanked graciously because they have brought us to $600, which I think is a worthy interim goal. Of course, if we got a little bit more than that, nobody would complain by calling too.
I certainly wouldn't.
I know you wouldn't, because we've kept you... Have we kept you awake? What time did you get up?
Yeah, well, I actually got up around 10 o'clock because I spent all day producing my internet show.
PM, you mean?
Well, you know, I got home.
10 p.m. is when you got.
I got home from working for 12 hours yesterday at 8 o'clock this morning.
Yeah.
And I was so tired that I went to sleep until noon, which was not good because I have to mail a program to Texas for broadcast Saturday morning on the Internet. But it got to the post office in time, and if they don't screw me over, as they do very frequently, yeah, we should have a new show on this Saturday.
It's that damned Internet again. And this
speaking of the damned Internet, let me give myself a little plug. If you want to know what's upcoming on the Golden Age of Radio on WBAI or on the Internet show, which is Saturday mornings on an Internet station called YesterdayUSA.com, Golden Age of Radio is at 11 a.m. on the Internet, and I have an announce page on Facebook, which is Facebook.com/MaxGoldenAge.
Oh, very good. You finally did that.
Well, I actually registered it as Golden Age of Radio hosted by Max Schmid, but that's a little cumbersome.
It really is. It
Max
really is.
Max Golden Age takes you there. Golden Age, of course, was long gone, but Max Golden Age will get you to the important pages.
Very good. And, of course, there's also the
like
Hour
me,
of the...
Love me.
And there's the, yes, everybody should love you. And there's the Hour of the Wolf group there as well, which is actually, you just have, I didn't get a special name, it's a group. It's not a fan page or anything, it's a group page. And you just go to Facebook and you type in Hour of the Wolf. And it will
And what designation did you take for yourself? I picked Entertainer because I didn't like the options.
I think it was similar. I think it was similar, but...
And Facebook doesn't understand radio or audio or anything.
Yeah, a Google Plus makes it a little bit easier, but then there ain't nobody there at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good service, it's a better service, but it's an empty service. So, although I'm trying it out with my Nexus 7, I'm so pleased to have gotten that little sucker. It's adorable.
Isn't it great to be a reviewer? I don't even
No, Max. No? I bought this.
My goodness.
And you don't get to keep hardware when you're a reviewer. You get to keep software. The hardware you send back to the manufacturer. You know, if you're legitimate and not one of those fake bloggers, of which there are a lot. But no, we send our hardware.
Or even radio reviewers of one sort.
Yeah, well, they're close to fake blog. I mean, you go to some of the trade shows, and there are more BAI people there than at a staff meeting sometimes. But I actually occasionally make a living doing that. But I have to admit that, you know, Hank Key and Joe King and those folk, they're quite legitimate as well.
Yeah, well, and you get to hold the stuff in your hand, at least for a while.
You get loaners. I have no problem getting loaners of hardware. It's just that I give them back. But no, this is a tablet that I bought myself. It's my very first tablet of my own. I have had a review copy of a Samsung product in the past. But this is my own, paid for. It is now 2 days old. That's as long as anybody's had their hands on a Nexus 7. I'm naming mine Rutger.
And what's the operating system on this?
Android 4.1 Jelly Bean.
But this is a form of Android or not?
Yes, this is Android 4.1.
Ah, Android, okay. Which has overtaken iPad and iWatchamacallit.
Yes, for the moment. Until the iPhone 5 comes out, which will probably then eclipse, you know, it's leapfrog. I mean, I'm an Android person, and I'm, you know, an anti-Apple person in as far as corporate politics are concerned. Although I have to say I'm not happy with the corporate politics of late of Google. But having said that, where was I going off? Oh, yes. I have no idea what I was going to say. I was looking at, like, three things at once.
Well, you know, when words fail, there is one thing you can say. 212-209-2950.
Put in the numbers where the words fail. Indeed. What in God's... I was saying, this is my very first tablet. And I'm very, very pleased with that. And which is the dominant operating system? You know what? In 2 years, it could be Windows on the phone. I used to have a Windows, not a phone, but a PDA, and I loved it.
Is that Windows 8?
Windows 8 Mobile.
They announced the launch date for Windows 8 in October.
Yes, actually, I'm not sure if that was official or rumor, but it should be. But I mean, they need to come out with it, if anything, a little bit earlier, because they need to have the operating systems in there, by Christmas time. So,
our desktop's dead.
One of the reasons Vista got such terrible, terrible reviews was because it came out in January, when the manufacturers and the corporate buyers and everybody's annual budget was gone. And the reviewers didn't have their chance to put their paws on it. It's one of the reasons why Vista, which you, if you installed from scratch, was a perfectly legitimate operating system, worked just fine, why everybody had bad things to say about it. It wasn't that it didn't work, it worked fine. As long as you didn't patch it over like Win95 or something.
Yeah.
By the way, a phone call is coming in at this very moment.
Let's push on to 750, 760. Sky's the limit, a grand.
Who knows where it will end? We've got 5 minutes left. 212-209-2950. And for a $60 pledge, you can get an amazing almost 45 hours, and by the time Max is done, probably will be 45 hours, of radio interviews, dramas, discussion of, by, and created based upon the works of Ray Bradbury, the great Ray Bradbury, who died 6 weeks ago at age 91. 212-209-2950 makes you a subscriber to WBAI, shows your support for dramatic and literary programs on WBAI. And
it shows that overnight radio is not dead.
It merely seems
someone
that way.
Someone recently might have tried to kill it, but it's not dead.
Indeed, indeed. 212-209-2950. Our tally is exactly at 600 in 4 minutes. We could easily break that to 750. I don't want to.
209-2950. $60 for our two-disc Ray Bradbury compilation that we call, not unreasonably,
the best of Ray Bradbury. 212-209-2950. No calls are on the phone at the moment. The one has already been taken. So let us push on slowly and steadily, and we can break that number and make it higher. Buy a CD for yourself and buy a set of the CDs for a friend. That would give us $120.
Or your kid, or grandkid.
Indeed.
Or grandfather.
And
or grandmother.
I was going to say, or grandfather. 212-209-2950 is the number to call.
And your call now supports live radio in the overnight.
Yes, exactly, as opposed to a lot
somewhat
of
a rarity in fun drive times.
Yeah, I mean, as it is, as soon as this show is over, we're going to recording. And, you know, it would be nice to show the powers that be that live radio is something that you treasure, and that fun, freeform, literate live radio is even better. Call now, 212-209-2950. At 6:56:30, I have to put my outro on the air.
Well, let me get a last-minute plug in, then.
Yes, do that.
By the way, it's been a pleasure being on the program, even if I couldn't get into the station due to my ridiculous work and sleep schedule.
Not to mention the lack of air conditioning and the horrible, horrible weather it is outside.
I have that here, too, the lack of air conditioning.
Oh, dear.
But on Sunday night, when hopefully everything will be back to normal,
uh-huh,
I will be on the air from 7 to 11 this week, 7 to 11.
Ooh, great numbers
Golden
there.
Age of Radio. We will have another Ray Bradbury story, probably a version of Mars Has Happened from an unknown series called Think.
Ooh.
Also known as ABC Radio Theater.
Ah, that That's I've heard.
By Morton Fine. I'm not sure if David Friedkin was with him on this, but I thought they always wrote together. And anyone who knows the names of Fine and Friedkin, they were two of radio's really best writers. And it's a whole different take on Mars Is Heaven. we will also be featuring, because it was such a success on Sunday, we have a brand new premium of Gene Shepherd, the most incredibly rare programs found in the estate of his second wife, Lois Nettleton.
What?
Yes, they were married in the 1950s until she threw, until they divorced in the mid-1960s.
What? And Lois Nettleton?
Estate, yes, she was known on the show as The Caller, because she used to call him in the when he was doing the overnight show. And apparently they hooked up and they were married for many years.
Lois Lane? Lois Nettleton? Lois Lane?
No, not Lois Lane. Lois Nettleton.
No, Lois Nettleton, the other actress, yes.
Yes. And in her estate
but
was
still
a box marked Antique Dolls. And in that box, which is probably why Shepard didn't take it when they split, was a collection of reel-to-reel tapes that includes 6 2-hour Saturday shows and 4.5 4-hour Sunday shows. This is a major find in the world of Gene Shepherd, and we'll be listening to one of those shows on Sunday night. You can also get that at give2wpai.org. That premium also available, but we'll be going in-depth on Sunday.
Yeah, 212-209-2950. We have 1 minute left before I have to start my theme. Of course, I often start it silently, you know, and then, you know, ramp it up as we continue to go off the air. I assume Tony is going to come in.
Yes, well, you know, I'm sure he's very busy working on the Al Jazeera newscast.
He's doing that right now. I can see him through the glass window.
Well, you know, we service the network. Tony and me produced that mess.
And
two
here,
news shows in the overnight, Monday through Friday.
Yeah, and here he comes now. To put on that wonderful program. 212-209-2950. I have nothing against it other than the fact that it's recorded and we ought to be doing live radio at this hour.
Hopefully it will at least be successful. Not as successful as we've been.
Yes, we've done okay. 660.
Yeah, someone else call. Let's get to 720. One more
Let's
call.
Let's get to
720. More
two more calls. I'm going to start the outro in the background while Tony is going to use the other computer to create the null atmosphere that will be coming your way at 3 a.m.
Don't forget to grab the disc out of the machine, Jim.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thank you. thank you. That's good. Otherwise, I would have been halfway home and had to turn around and come back. 212-209-2950 is the number to call as Steel Eye Span slowly.
Yes, you can take your cells of silver, or you can get your golden apples of the sun.
Indeed. Oh, they certainly actually go together, don't they?
Well,
think about the lyrics. You know, I set my sails of silver and steer towards the sun is the song. So it's steer towards the golden apples of the sun, right?
Well, we've been celebrating Ray Bradbury tonight here on an extended Hour of the Wolf. We urge you at this last minute. You know, this premium, you know, is not going away. It's on the website, and I'll be offering it again Sunday night. But right now, while you're listening, while you're locked in and hooked in, give us a call, 212-209-2950. You know, it could disappear at the end of this fun drive sometime in a week or so. Don't miss this opportunity. I mean, I can think of no better premium. It's radio. It's brilliant writing. It's great adaptations.
It's Bradbury.
Full production, 212-209-2950. Don't miss this chance.
Indeed. Thank you, Max.
Thank you,
Jim. So much. And I will talk to you off the air. Not tonight, I suspect.
Oh, I got a lot of catching up of TV watching tonight.
No, there you go. So give me a ring at home.
Gotta burn off that DVR.
There you go. Burn off those DVRs. There's a premium for that as well, I think. Burning off DVRs, isn't there?
Yeah. Magic.
Yes, indeed. And it's in the water. 212-209-2950. Thank you again, Max. Thank you very, very, very much, and Antoinette, for taking all the calls and being so prompt in the tally. That's really refreshing and wonderful.
Okay, I'll say.
Okay. No, she was great.
Someone who knows the tally job and what it's all about.
She does. She does. Okay. So, everybody visit Max on Facebook. I'm on Facebook. Or go to ourwolf.com to see what an old website looks like.
And Max Golden Age for the Facebook page. Facebook/Max Golden Age.
Okay, I think the band is playing us off.
All right.
It's, well, like, it's like the Academy Awards.
Well, goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Good night.
Good night.
Hi, this is Jerry Stiller. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Where are my keys? Anybody see my keys? Who took my keys?
City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting live and video streaming from our studios in New York City, and I welcome all of you, especially the tens of thousands of you per week, brand new, primarily younger listeners and viewers. We're here to empower people. We take on the issues that are frequently not addressed by the mainstream or alternative media: health and healing, the environment, social issues, the power of positive thought, and original investigative reporting. Today, all of those. First up, of course, we will look at the latest on health and healing. From then, my guest, Professor James Horn, we're going to talk about the dumbing down of students, from high-stakes testing and the corporatization of the school system and resegregation of our schools. I will have a continuation of our original in-depth investigative white paper report on Bad to the Bone. Our entire pharmaceutical medical industrial complex needs complete overhaul. There is so much corruption. And the problem is that we hear about this and we don't do anything about it at all. So I'm making specific examples. In the last two discussions, I've talked about GlaxoSmithKline. Today, I'll be talking about Merck. And I'm sure many of the drugs I'm going to be discussing, you're probably taking or know someone who is. And then the question is, did you know that if you die and you sue or your state sues, that's just built into the cost of doing business. So fraud is a part of the whole marketing plan, and they get away with it. And I'll be specific on that. Then a short commentary from Chris Hedges. War is betrayal, persistent myths of combat. And this is in the Boston Review. Also today, if time permits, Monsanto, a modern-day plague. And this is a call out to our president to stand up and have the courage and the decency of closing the door to the White House and to legislation that allows Monsanto to virtually do anything it wants involving its genetically engineered seeds. But I'm going to tell you about the whole history of Monsanto. This is a criminal organization that should have been dealt with a long time ago. I'm going to tell you about its criminal history. And then you decide for yourself if you want these people walking in and out of Congress and making laws. From Dr. Sandra Pellingeri from Global Research, Smart Meter Dangers. This is a more definitive report on the health hazards of wireless electromagnetic radiation exposure. Now, across the country, there's a major move to get smart meters on every home in the United States. And we're told it's good. And they spin the story that, well, they can monitor how much utility energy you're using and therefore make it less expensive. Not true. That has nothing to do with this. I'll tell you why they really are putting smart meters on, how much of an electromagnetic burst of energy you're getting per day, and why it's all dangerous, all the time. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Something very intriguing, but we've discussed this with several scientists in the past 20 years, and that's when we began to see that different cultures around the world use different healing techniques. For example, Gregorian chants. Have you ever been in a quiet place, played some of their music? It is so mesmerizing. It is so calming. But then listen to Mozart. Listen to Beethoven. Listen to something in an environment. The key is, are you in an environment? In a concert hall is one thing, but if you've ever sat in nature, in front of a brook or stream, or overlooked a pasture, or been in a Shakespearean wild flower garden, and suddenly you have this music, you have two different stimuli simultaneously. One you can see and smell and feel, and then one you can hear. Or how about meditation and just the repetition of a single statement or sound? All of these are known to improve a person's immune system. But how? Now the latest on this. Scientists have now proven that the DNA can be reprogrammed by words and frequencies. This is about what they're calling the power of hypercommunication. And this is an important study that was done in Russia. We know that the DNA is a biological internet, and we know that it works, according to the Russian scientific research, directly and indirectly, by phenomena that we have hitherto not been able to explain. In my own case, my mother was what is known as a sensitive. That meant that she had the ability to sit and talk with people and have a vibration that gave her an insight into what a person needed, and then in a very positive and reassuring way would promote the idea of do something good with your diet or your body or life. She helped so many people. Today we know that if you are sensitive to auras, the people around you, if you engage in acts of healing, if you've engaged in acts of self-healing, if you are an intuitive, this is not mumbo-jumbo. It may have been commercialized, many people to exploit it, but indeed it exists. There's evidence it's a whole new type of medicine in which DNA can be influenced and reprogrammed by words and frequencies without cutting out and replacing single genes. Now, we've been told that only 10% of our DNA is being used for building proteins. Okay. Let us not assume for a moment that nature created the other 90% for no purpose. So when the Russians went to examine what is called junk DNA, which is about 90%, they found that this junk DNA was able to actually function in a way that we had not understood. According to them, our DNA is not only responsible for the construction of our body, but also serves as data storage. And in communication, the Russian linguists found that the genetic code, especially in the apparently useless 90% of our DNA, follows the same rules as all human languages. That meant that, let's say you have a rules of syntax. Syntax, by the way, means the way in which words are put together to form phrases and sentences. And then we have semantics, that is the study of the meaning in language forms. And then you have the basic rules of grammar. Well, what they discovered, which was really revolutionary, that the alkalines of our DNA follow a regular grammar, and they have a set of their own rules just like languages. So the question is then, human languages did not appear coincidentally, but are a reflection of our inherent DNA. The Russian biophysicist, molecular biologist Gargevich and his colleagues also explored the vibrational behavior of the DNA. And what they found was, quote, living chromosomes function like solitonic and holographic computers using the endogenous DNA laser radiation, end quote. What that means is they manage to modulate certain frequency patterns on a laser ray and with it influence the DNA frequency and thus the genetic information itself. Now, let us go back to Gabriel Cousins, or Norman Cousins, back in the 1970s. I met Gabriel Cousins. I was working as a research fellow in anti-aging medicine at the Institute of Applied Biology, but I also was doing vibrational medicine research at the same time. He was of the belief that if he watched comedies, even though he had a medically irreversible condition that no one could help, that it was improving. Now, he didn't understand why it was improving, but he knew it did. So he focused on the what. The what was there was a phenomenon happening. At that time, I spoke with several leading holistic humanistic psychologists, Dr. Carmi Harari, Dr. Norman Shepherd, Dr. Alan Putterman. These are people I knew personally, work with them. And they were all engaged in some very exciting work, believing, but hadn't yet proved, that anything that stimulates a positive vibration, that includes humor, laughter, love, joy, positive excitement, something that enthralls us, or what I call the creation of remarkable moments, also helps heal us. And indeed, when you look at the power of humor and why we should have humor in our lives, Norman Cousins was later found to be correct, because a whole field called psycho, meaning the psyche, neuro, the neurological system, immunology, psychoneuroimmunology, show that when you think a positive thought, your body corresponds with positive biochemistry. You think a negative thought, negative biochemistry. Now, here's what all this means, and here this how this ties together. When you put a person in a healing environment and you ask them to be silent, it forces their senses into paying attention to the environment they're in, hence mindful meditation. When you get a person focused on one vibration, a vibration of peaceful, harmonizing energy, like as if in early meditation where they would get people to focus by just saying Om, they go Om.